Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. We want to thank Pastor Don Pieper and the Green Valley Evangelical Lutheran Church for hosting this debate and allowing us to use this facility at absolutely no cost. His hunger and his hunger for dialogue and search for truth has led him to let us have this facility and use it for free. We want to thank everybody that's working behind the scenes on this. Although the debates are very entertaining, we're holding this debate to challenge you, to stimulate your thinking processes. These speakers may help give you more resolve for a position that you already hold, or they may present to you new evidence for a position that you thought you would never even consider. Please be advised that we expect everybody here to behave in a courteous, respectful way. Let's not have any outbursts from either side. If you cannot control yourself, please step outside or you're going to be asked to leave. Steve Gregg lives in Santa Cruz, California. He rents a car, pays for his own gas, doesn't ask for food, lodging, or anything. And to help him defer some of his expenses for coming here from Northern California or Central California, we have a gift box set up in the back with his name on it. And if you're blessed tonight and would like to thank him, then please consider dropping in a small gift for him. We ask that no applause be given until the end of the debate, as it may interrupt the flow of thought of our debaters. We can show them both our appreciation for their hard work by applauding at the end. Please write down your questions so that at the end we will be able to take questions for both sides. And if we don't get to your questions, both speakers will be available afterwards to talk with you. In our debate tonight, taking the side of atheism, is Dr. William Ramsey, professor of philosophy at UNLV. Taking the side of theism will be Steve Gregg, author, radio talk show host, and Bible lecturer. The proposition tonight will be, is there a God? This position will be held in the affirmative by Steve Gregg. Before we start, we're going to ask Dr. Don Pieper to come up and give us a word of prayer. And Steve will be going first afterwards.
We pray.
Is that on? Okay, that's on. Thanks. 20 minutes?
22.
22. Okay, good. Well, thank you all for coming. I want to thank also my worthy opponent, Bill Ramsey, for coming. We had some conversation beforehand. He's very congenial. I expect this to be a very congenial exchange, even though we are on opposite sides of a proposition, the proposition being there is a God, and of course the atheist position is that there is no God. So I'm here to tell you that why I believe that believing in God is a reasonable position. And I want to be quite honest with you. Oh, I should be honest about one thing first, is I didn't rent a car this time. So my expenses were less. A friend of mine drove me down in his car, so don't you get the impression that I'm putting out money that I'm not putting out to come here. But sometimes I usually rent a car and come. That can be stricken from the record. Okay. I want to say at the very beginning that this presentation is going to be mostly about what I consider to be evidences for the existence of God or reasons to believe in the existence of God. But I want to be very honest with you. One of the strongest reasons for my belief in God is that I don't mean this to sound arrogant, but I know God. I've met him. He's been involved in my life for over 50 years. And in fact, he's been involved in my life more than, and in many ways, that he would not have been if I'd just gone a traditional religious route as I had grown up to, but I branched out into a more faith-ventured type of lifestyle that was inspired by a man in the 1900s or in the 1800s named George Mueller. And I've lived, I would say, by faith for 40 years. I've raised 5 children. I live a debt-free life. I've never let my finances be known to anyone ever, my needs. I've never asked for money. I don't send out a newsletter. And for 40 years, month by month, not in any surplus, but not in any deficit, God has provided in answer to my prayers. Now, that's not going to convince somebody who's not a believer in God. But I just want to be honest with you. I believe I have rational reasons other than personal reasons for believing that God exists. But if somebody says, well, if it could be proven that God doesn't exist, would you then stop being a Christian? Would you stop believing in God? Well, I suppose I would have to, because I'm an intellectually honest person. If you could prove that God doesn't exist, I'd have to change my position. But you could as easily prove to me that my parents don't exist, because I've known God almost as long as I've known them. And he generally has been so active in my life that it'd be very hard for any amount of evidence for me to be interpreted against his existence, just like it'd be hard to presenting evidence that would convince me my parents didn't exist. But as far as, apart from my personal experience with God, and it would be unwise, I realize that when you speak up personal experience with God, you're dealing with really the best evidence that God exists, except that it's the most likely to be ridiculed. Because everyone can say, well, the Muslims have their experience with God, and the Sikhs have their experience with God, and the Buddhists have theirs, or the Buddhists don't believe in God, but Hindus have theirs with their gods, and Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons have theirs, and all this is true. And it's not my desire here to debate whether the Mormon version or the Jehovah's Witness version or the Christian version, or for that matter, the Muslim version of God, is the more correct view. I would like to debate that with those who hold those different positions, because I believe that can be established from evidence also. But my desire tonight is much less ambitious than to prove any particular religious notion of God, because we're not talking about whether Christianity is true, but whether theism is true. Is there a God? That's the first thing we have to decide. Once we've decided if there is a God, and if the affirmative is our answer, then we have a whole new project to decide whether the Christian version, the biblical version, is the God who is there, or whether it's another. I'm a fully convinced Christian. I believe in the Bible. But those are not the things I've come here to defend tonight. I'd love to defend those on another occasion. There's just too much ground to try to cover in 20 minutes. So I'm going to take the much less ambitious project and just discuss whether atheism makes sense or theism makes sense more as a worldview. Now, I'd rather speak of worldviews than religions, because I'm not an extremely religious person. I never really have been since I was a teenager. I left the church I was raised in, and I've just been a follower of Jesus. I know him. He and I have walked together for many years, and I just am not wrapped up in any particular religious system. I embrace the Christian religion, but I'm not wanting to give particularly religious arguments for the existence of God. I just want to say that if a person follows the views of the modern atheist books that have come out, especially since 2006, when several different atheist books came out all at once, by Richard Dawkins and by Christopher Hitchens and by Sam Harris. Sam Harris had an earlier book in 2004, by Dan Dennett. Then you'll rule out the idea that there's a God, and you might not seek the God that made you. And I would like to say there is still good reason to believe that there is a God who made you, and that there is one that we ought to seek to know. Now, I would start with the most basic things that I would hope almost everyone could agree upon, because that's the best place to start talking about a controversial subject, start where people agree. And I think that most people would have to agree that something is ultimate. Something is the explanation for everything. Something, it was here before all that we see was here. Now, whether that something was God, as most religions would say, or whether that something was natural law, matter and energy, as materialists might say, or whether it's something else, something non-personal and something non-material, perhaps. Whatever we may put in that position in our thinking, there was something that was there that explains everything that has come about since. The material universe came about, most physicists and most astronomers and scientists of almost all disciplines believe, by a Big Bang. Now, it's not my interest to discuss whether I think the Big Bang is the best explanation of the origin of the universe or not, but let's take that as a starting point since most scientists believe it. The Big Bang is usually considered to be the beginning of the universe, the beginning of even of time, the beginning of natural law, and everything else has come out from that. But since the Big Bang is really the beginning of nature, whatever was before that or whatever caused the Big Bang cannot be part of nature. And therefore, whatever is ultimate, whatever stands behind nature, whatever stands behind the universe as its cause, it is my contention, is something that is not part of nature. And is therefore, the only word we have to explain something that's not part of nature would be supernatural, unless it's subnatural. But supernatural would seem to be the best explanation. So you either believe that nature is ultimate, or that something or someone supernatural is ultimate. Now, we do know some things, and we all know these things. We know, for example, there are laws of cause and effect. All scientists believe this. All scientists use these laws and have counted on them. And the laws of cause and effect tell us that for every effect, there must be an adequate cause. Now, the word adequate is very important, because an effect cannot have been caused by an inadequate cause, something that's not adequate to produce it. All that we see, the universe, life, everything we see, is the effect of some cause. And the question must be asked, what cause is adequate to produce the things we see? Now, that's what I would like to examine. However, there are some, atheists especially, who have suggested that the ultimate is simply the universe itself, or maybe a previous universe. Maybe there's multiverse. Maybe there's many universes, and some of the early ones caused this one. For example, Bertrand Russell, in his essay, Why I'm Not a Christian, said, there's no reason why the world could not have come into being without a cause, nor, on the other hand, is there any reason why it should not have always existed. There is no reason to suppose that the world had a beginning at all. The idea that things must have a beginning is really due to the poverty of our imagination. Therefore, perhaps I need not waste any more time upon the argument about the first cause. So in an essay about Why I'm Not a Christian, he says, I don't really need to spend much time on the question of first cause because, as far as I'm concerned, the world itself could be the first cause. It may be uncaused. Maybe the universe itself was always there. Well, the problem with that particular suggestion is, A, there's hardly a scientist in the world today who would agree with him that the world was always there. Stephen Hawking, for example, who's certainly one of the deans of the sciences today, he said almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Stephen Hawking also wrote elsewhere, he said, the odds against the universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang are enormous. I think there are clearly religious implications, he says. Now, Stephen Hawking's not a Christian, not even a theist. But he said the odds against a universe like ours emerging from a Big Bang, the odds against it are staggering, he said. He says, I think there are clearly religious implications. He didn't say theistic, but certainly there are things that cause awe. There are things that we marvel at, we cannot explain, and that science may never be able to explain. The point is, though, if Bertrand Russell said, well, who knows, maybe the world was always here. Well, he's not in step with modern science, and he can't be faulted for that. He lived before the Big Bang cosmology became dominant in scientific community. But since the time of the Big Bang notion becoming popular, all scientists, or almost all scientists, Stephen Hawking said, believed that the universe had a beginning. Now, if something had a beginning, generally speaking, we'd say it had a cause. Now, one reason that I personally would reject, even if I were not a Christian believer, I would reject the idea of nature having caused itself, or nature being ultimate, or the universe being ultimate, is because whatever is natural is subject to natural laws. We know of no exception. We don't know of anything in nature that doesn't subject itself or is subject to natural law. And some of the most unyielding and universal laws of nature that scientists count on are the laws of thermodynamics. Now, sometimes atheists use the first law of thermodynamics to say that the universe didn't come into existence because the first law says that no matter or energy can be destroyed and none is ever created. Of course, that's ruling out the possibility of a supernatural creation, and that's begging the question, isn't it? Because we're trying to ask whether there could have been an original supernatural creation. But the second law says that it's the law of increasing entropy, that with every transition of matter to energy, there is a loss of available energy resulting in an increase in randomness or entropy. Everything breaks down. Now, evolutionists believe that in the living world, because of natural selection, that the living world has moved from, you know, simple things to more complex things. That's not specifically what I'm here to debate right now, although I have my disagreements with evolution also. But the point is, even if evolution is true, it only holds true in the biological sphere, not in the sphere of the universe. All of nature is subject to the laws of entropy. Everything's breaking down. Eventually, the sun itself will burn out, and all the stars will burn out because they're made of fuel that is burning. And the law of entropy says eventually this will burn up and they won't be here anymore. They can't have been here forever and ever, or else they would have burned up forever and ever ago. Nature cannot have always been here because it is subject to its own laws, and nature had to have a beginning. It had to have a starting point from which to wear down from. And therefore, my own thinking would lead me to believe, even if I had not been exposed to any religion, that the founder of nature, the creator of nature, must be supernatural, something that is itself or himself not subject to the laws of nature, not subject to entropy. And that leads me in the direction of believing in theism, of course. Now, there are certain things that we know that I think lead to the conclusion that there is a God, and that we're not talking here about what they call a God of the gaps. Critics of theism sometimes say, well, you just believe in a God of the gaps. And what that means is there are gaps in our scientific knowledge. There are things we don't know yet. Science hasn't figured out yet. And in order to explain them, theists just stick in God there. The ancient people didn't know why a volcano goes up, so they said the volcano God makes it happen. Now seismologists and geologists can tell us why volcanoes blow up. We don't need a God there to make the volcano blow up. And so they say everything that was once attributed to the domain of God will someday be explained by scientists, and then the gaps in our knowledge will close up and squeeze God right out. There won't be any room for God anymore. And that you Christians who believe there's a God to create DNA or to create the universe, you're just postulating a God of the gaps. You're just putting God into a position because we don't know everything yet. No, the reason I believe in God is because of the things we do know. There's lots of things we don't know, I'll admit it, and many of them may be discovered in the future. I'm not worried about right now the things we don't know. I would argue from the things we do know. This is not arguing from ignorance. This is arguing from what is known, what everyone in this room knows. For example, we all know that life has never been known to arise without a living predecessor. It's never been seen to happen. It has not been made to happen in a laboratory. And yet, in order to believe that there is an unliving source, an unliving cause for the effect that we see of life requires that there must have been a time when a non-living set of chemicals in some way became a living set of chemicals. Now, it's a nice thing to suggest. It's the only thing you can suggest if there's no God. But we don't know that there's no God. What we do know is no one has ever seen non-life in any way through any process become living. And therefore, we can say one thing we do know is until scientists find out something otherwise, all experiments, all observations tell us that life does not arise from anything except previously existing life. Therefore, the effect of life must have a cause adequate to produce it, and a non-living cause would not be adequate. Distinguished Professor John Haldane said, "Origin of life theories do not provide a sufficient explanation, since they presume the existence of at an early stage of self-replication, and it has not been shown that this can arise by natural means from a material base." You need self-replication. Professor Haldane says it has not ever been shown that this can happen from a material base. Now, maybe it can, but no one has shown that it can. We do see life come about all the time, but we always see it come from other life. Therefore, if we're to go by observational knowledge, which is pretty general, I mean, we've seen a lot of life, then we would have to say, well, life, apparently, it has not been shown that life can arise from anything that's not alive. Anthony Flew, who used to be one of the leading atheists in this country, recently became a deist. He believes there's a God, but he's not a Christian. And he said, the philosophical question that has not been answered in Origin of Life studies is this: how can a universe of mindless matter produce beings with intrinsic ends, self-replication capabilities, and coded chemistry? Here we are not dealing with biology, but an entirely different category of problem. Former atheist, Anthony Flew. Andy Knoll, who's a professor of biology at Harvard, said, I think we have to admit that we're looking through a glass darkly here. We don't know how life started on this planet. In an interview with Ben Stein, in a movie some of you probably saw called Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, Richard Dawkins was asked where life began. And he said, we don't know. And Stein said, so you have no idea how it started? Dawkins said, no, nor has anybody. Stein said, what do you think of the possibility that intelligent design might turn out to be an answer to some of the issues in genetics and evolution? And Richard Dawkins, who's a very strong and dogmatic atheist, said this, quote, it could come about in the following way. It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto this planet. Now that is a possibility, he says, and an intriguing possibility. And I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence that if you look at the details of biochemistry, molecular biology, you might find a signature of some sort of a designer. Unquote. Now, Dawkins is absolutely intolerant of scientists who call themselves believers in intelligent design. But he said, well, you know, you might, if you look carefully at molecular biology, you might see a signature of a designer there. But then he hastened to say, oh, but the designer couldn't be God. It had to be creatures like ourselves or better, more, fully evolved than ourselves. But they have to be part of nature too. Why? Because he says so? Why should we believe that? If Dawkins himself has to resort to the suggestion that, you know, maybe intelligent design is the only explanation, he has to go and say, but it can't be God. I totally disagree with him. Sam Harris, in his letter to a Christian nation, said, how the process of evolution got started is still a mystery, but that does not in the least suggest that a deity is likely to be lurking in the bottom of it all. Well, it does not suggest it to Sam Harris, who rules out that possibility, but an open-minded person would say maybe it does suggest that. If intelligence is needed and life is needed to be a cause of life, maybe it does suggest a creator. Maybe there's other possibilities, and maybe it doesn't necessarily boil down obviously to the God of the Bible. That would have to be investigated separately. But why should we say we don't need a creator in this picture? Well, no one has shown yet that anything other than a creator can produce life. And also the information is in the cell. I'm afraid I'm running low on time. How much time do I have?
A minute and a half,
okay. I wanted to give many more points, but I'm a little too long-winded, as you probably have already noticed. One thing also we know, besides that life doesn't come from non-life, is that information always proceeds from intelligent minds seeking to communicate. A gene is a collection of information, genetic information, that has to be transmitted and read and understood by parts of the cell to make protein molecules. And this information is like linguistic information. And it is read like writing on a page is read by intelligent minds. It is written. And the RNA and the DNA have to be able to read this information in order to build protein molecules. Now, scientists more and more, including many who are not at all Christians, are saying, what is the origin of information? Information is not simply biological. Information is supra-biological. It has to do with information is something else. For example, if you and I were walking on the beach and we saw a bunch of sticks and stones scattered on the sand, we'd say, well, that's a product of nature. That there's no design to this. If we saw sticks that were laid out in, say, the form of a triangle, we might say, well, that could still be natural, but that's quite a coincidence that it came out in a perfect triangle, these three sticks. However, if you saw a series of sticks laid out spelling out the words, John loves Mary, you would never be able to suggest that was a natural phenomenon, not just because it's hard for nature to produce that structure, but because the structure itself has information content. And we know of no source of information except intelligence.
Time.
And I'll close with that for now. Thank you.
On? Can you hear me? Okay, I'm not going to respond to Steve's initial statements now. I'll do that later. So let me begin by first off just saying thanks to Joe and to Steve and to all of you for inviting me here this evening. I taught at Notre Dame for a number of years, about 18 years, and after a while I sort of came to be known as the village atheist there. And there was a pretty funny line that people would use to describe my being there, and it was, "What's a nice place like this doing with a guy like you?" And I suspect maybe a few of you are asking yourself that same question this evening, but I want you to know that I really appreciate the open-mindedness and the willingness to listen to alternative viewpoints. I think that's a really admirable thing. Secondly, let me just say a little bit about my objectives this evening. You know, usually when there's a debate, each side is trying to win all the arguments and convince everybody that they're right and the other guy's wrong. But that's actually really not my objective this evening. First off, as a philosopher, I'm really not that interested in just simply winning the arguments. I'm really more interested in trying to figure out what's right, and I'm sure Steve feels exactly the same way. And secondly, in terms of convincing you, I realize that for most of you, your religious views are very important to you. They mean a great deal to you, and you've given a tremendous amount of thought to them, and nothing I'm going to say this evening is probably going to convince you that I'm right and that you're wrong. And moreover, I'm not even sure I would like to do that. I mean, I realize that for many of you, your religious beliefs are extremely important. They give you a great sense of fulfillment and happiness. And if you were to abandon those views, you would find that to be fairly distressing and depressing, and I really don't want to do that to anybody. So then what do I want to do? What is my goal? You know, I'm not a professional debater, and as a matter of fact, religion, philosophy of religion, is not even my main area of specialization. However, if people ask me to explain my religious views and explain why I hold the views that I hold, then I'm more than happy to do that. And since you've asked me to do that this evening, that's what I'm going to do. All right. So first off, a little bit about myself. I was raised Christian. I was raised in the United Methodist Church. I grew up in a small community in Central Oregon. And I went to church on a fairly regular basis as a child. I was even temporarily in the junior church choir, although I suspect if you ask other people in the choir, their first hint that maybe there's no benevolent God was being forced to listen to me sing. But anyhow, eventually I started moving away from faith, and it wasn't something that happened overnight. It took a number of years, and it involved a number of different sorts of factors and different considerations, and I can't explain all of those this evening, but I wanted to touch on a couple of them. One sort of factor that came into play in my abandoning my religious beliefs stemmed from reflection upon my own religious beliefs and how those came about. When I asked myself, now why am I a Christian, I realized that it really wasn't a function of any kind of careful analysis of the different world's religions and deciding that Christianity is the one that's the most plausible or the one that's most clearly supported by evidence. No, I realized that I formed my religious beliefs in the way in which many people form their religious beliefs. I was simply taught this by my parents. And it was sort of an accident that I happened to be born in a Christian household. Had I been born in a Jewish household or a Muslim household, I would have very different religious views. All right. Now, the mere fact that my parents taught me these beliefs doesn't in itself make them bad. It doesn't mean that they're false. They taught me a lot of things that I still believe. But with a lot of those other things that they taught me, those beliefs were grounded ultimately in some sort of process or some sort of method that we know to be conducive to revealing the truth. For example, my parents taught me that the earth is round, and I realize that that kind of a claim is grounded in years of scientific investigation and years of scientific evidence. So what about the religious beliefs? Well, I realize that my parents formed their religious beliefs in much the same way I did. They were simply taught that by their parents, and they were taught that by their parents, and so on and so on and so on. So what about the ultimate source of those religious claims? What's the ultimate source for those claims? And I realize that those claims are ultimately grounded in statements and claims made by deeply religious individuals who lived 2,000 years ago, a few of these deeply religious individuals, and these were claims about somebody that they believed was the Messiah. Right? And I recognize that, generally speaking, that's not a very reliable source of information. For example, many of us, I suspect many of you, do not take at face value the claims made by the disciples of Muhammad. Or you do not take at face value, or do you not feel that the claims made of the followers of the first Buddha are reliable. There are a variety of individuals who claim to have some form of divinity, and then their followers say, we've witnessed miracles, we've seen these different things. And in all of these cases, you folks say, I'm not buying into it. I don't find that to be a very reliable process. All right, well, it seems to me that if we're going to be consistent, the same sort of reasoning should apply to the disciples of Jesus. All right? So I think initially part of my skepticism was due to the recognition that my religious beliefs were not formed in a way that was a very reliable form. Okay, so that's one kind of consideration. And there's other kinds of considerations that have to do more with specifics of the religious system itself. And I know Steve said he didn't want to talk about specifics, but I think for me, it's hard to separate general theism on the one hand from some of the specific claims on the other hand. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Now, one question you might have is, well, what exactly would a reliable belief-forming strategy be? Right? And a lot of times in these sorts of debates, people say, well, it's got to be deduction. It's got to be deductive inference. But the truth of the matter is there's all sorts of legitimate belief-forming strategies that are not deductive logic. They're not deductive inference. There's all sorts of perfectly rational and perfectly reasonable forms of non-deductive inference. And one of them that I think is helpful in this context is something called inference to the best explanation. When you make an inference to the best explanation, you adopt a hypothesis that does the best job of making sense of a certain set of facts, does the best job of explaining something out there that you want to have explained. All right? It's the kind of reasoning that you see in a detective novel, right? Sherlock Holmes comes across a crime scene. What happened here? He adopts the hypothesis that does the best job of explaining what actually took place. All right, now in our context this evening, we have two competing hypotheses. On the one hand, you have the theistic hypothesis, which is a claim that an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving, morally perfect being exists and cares about us and created the universe. And on the other hand, you have an atheistic hypothesis that simply says such a being does not exist. All right, well, from my perspective, with regard to a variety of different facts about both Scripture on the one hand and about the way the world is, the atheistic hypothesis does a better job of explaining those facts. Okay, so let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. I'm one of these people, when you go and see a movie, and if the movie doesn't really hang together, it really bothers me. Right? If there's gaps in the plot, or if one of the main characters does something that just doesn't make sense given other things that happen in the movie, that really bothers me. And moreover, notice that that sort of thing is exactly what we often use as an indicator that a particular story is false. Right? If you're a detective and you're interviewing a suspect, one thing you're going to be looking for in the story are various ways in which the story doesn't really make sense, various ways in which the story just doesn't really hang together. Well, I often feel that way about certain aspects of the Christian story. Not simply with regard to perhaps inconsistencies that appear in the Bible or certain errors that appear in the Bible. I'm talking about the core Christian claim. There are various ways in which, for me, it simply doesn't make sense. The core Christian claim or the sort of slogan that you often hear, is that Jesus died for our sins, or that Jesus died so that we might be saved. Sometimes the way this is put is people say, God sacrificed his only son for our salvation. Okay? Well, when you initially hear that, if you just focus on that specific claim, it seems incredibly admirable. Right? Because, of course, we have a tremendous amount of admiration for people who make a great sacrifice for the benefit of others. There's a tremendous nobility in that. When you hear about a soldier who throws himself on a grenade in a trench in order to save his buddies, we have a great deal of admiration for that. We think that's really quite impressive. But then suppose you find out in the soldier's story that in truth he was all alone in the trench. Or suppose you discover that the soldier could have deactivated the grenade by simply pushing a button that he had in his hand. Well, then that story of sacrifice really wouldn't make any more sense, right? And you might be inclined to look for some other explanation, like maybe the individual committed suicide or something. Well, that's how I feel about the central Christian story. To begin with, it really doesn't make sense to me that we need to be saved in the first place. The idea that we're all collectively tainted, or that we're all collectively guilty because of the actions of somebody who lived 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, that doesn't strike me as plausible. Right? The notion of collective guilt strikes me as a morally flawed notion. I believe that all of us are capable of both good and bad, and that whatever guilt we have in our life should be due to what we ourselves do, not what somebody else does. Okay, but let's not worry about that. Let's put that aside. Secondly, it's very important to remember that the God of Western theism, the God of Christianity, is omnipotent. He can do anything he wants by simply willing it. So if the God of Christianity wants to bring about the salvation of humanity, or at least the salvation of good Christians, he didn't need to sacrifice anybody. He could bring that about just by simply snapping his fingers. So this idea that God had to kind of use this means-end sort of strategy, well, I want to bring about the salvation of humanity, but the only way I can do that is by making this sacrifice, that just doesn't make sense to me when you're talking about an omnipotent being. But third and finally, why would the mechanism of salvation be us killing God's son? Right? I mean, a lot of people like to think of Jesus as a kind of emissary of God, where he was sent here to pass along a message. Well, normally, when people send a messenger, they don't like it when the people who are supposed to receive the message kill the messenger. And in this particular case, kill him in a uniquely horrible way. So I just don't understand why the mechanism or the device of salvation would be us, in effect, torturing Jesus to death. That just doesn't make sense to me. Now, looking at it from the other perspective, I can kind of make sense of things if you come at this from an atheistic perspective. I can kind of make sense of this story in the following way. If you're following somebody who you believe to be the Messiah, and you believe this individual is going to return the kingdom of Israel, and there'll be a lengthy period of peace afterwards, then you're in a very bad situation when the person you think is the Messiah is executed. That's a bad spot to be in. And you've got only a couple of choices. You can either abandon your religious beliefs, and I suspect perhaps some people did that, or what you can do is you can try to sort of put together some kind of a story or some kind of a narrative whereby the person you thought the Messiah, in fact, it's a good thing that he died, that it involves a sacrifice for our benefit. I can see how you might try to sort of put together a narrative that makes sense of what happened in that way and just sort of hope that people don't worry about things in the way that I worry about things. All right? So it seems to me that just the central core narrative of Christianity, it itself doesn't make sense, but I can kind of see how it came about if this is a human creation. All right, that's one kind of consideration. Let me give you another one. As long as we're talking about suffering, as Steve knows, and I'm sure most of you know, one of the most traditional problems with Western theism is something called the problem of evil. Why does an all-powerful, all-loving, all-knowing God permit the amount of suffering that we see in the world. Just this week, there were these horrendous earthquakes in Southeast Asia, and hundreds of people lost their lives. A lot of people lost their homes. There's a tsunami that went with it. And actually, on a sort of historical scale, this was a fairly minor catastrophe. Human history is just filled with all sorts of disasters and catastrophes that have killed thousands and thousands of people, many of them natural disasters, plagues, floods and earthquakes and things like that. And then, of course, there's the disasters that we bring about, that are brought about by humanity, in terms of wars and things along those lines. I think sometimes it's helpful to think of these in concrete terms. The thing that sort of focuses my mind with regard to this issue is think of a good Christian young child who is horribly burned over 80% of his body in some sort of a fire and lingers in a tremendous amount of pain and suffering for a number of weeks, and then eventually dies. It just doesn't seem like a benevolent, loving, caring God who has the capacity to prevent that from happening would choose not to do so. Okay? Now, as Steve and all of you know, there's a sort of minor industry in the philosophy of religion that tries to deal with this issue. It's called constructing a theodicy. And theodicies try to make sense of this kind of suffering from a Christian perspective or from a theistic perspective. And we can talk about some of those later if you'd like. Suffice to say that for me, I don't tend to find these theodicies completely convincing. But let's put aside earthly suffering and let's talk about a different kind of suffering. Suffering that the question is not so much why does God allow it, but why does God actually seem to be directly causing it? All right, now, step back for a minute and ask yourself, when we think of evil, what comes to mind? And certainly, on Earth, one of the paradigms of evil that often people bring up is Adolf Hitler. Right? And you ask yourself, well, what was it about Hitler that made him so evil? What was so monstrous about Hitler? And surely, one of the things that made Hitler so evil was his treatment of the Jews. Right? That he initiated the Holocaust, and that he tormented and murdered millions of Jews. Okay? And even if you happen to think, if you're a Christian who happens to think that in some sense Judaism is wrong, or in some sense Judaism is immoral, you have to admit that what Hitler did to the Jews was a horrendous, horrendous injustice. But now stop and think about it. What Hitler did to those Jews is nothing compared to what a Christian God is doing to those very same Jews right now. At least on the Orthodox view of Christianity, all non-believers await eternal damnation, a level of suffering and torment that we simply cannot imagine. And that's for an eternity. I suspect if we were to go to hell and we were to interview those Jews and we were to ask them, who do you think committed against you a greater injustice, Hitler or the Christian God? My hunch would be many of them would say the Christian God. This idea that an appropriate sort of punishment, if you think in some sense that Judaism is itself in some sense a crime, you have to admit that that punishment does not fit that crime. It's not just. Okay? Now, what am I really saying here? Am I saying that a Christian God really does exist and he's an evil, evil being? No. What I'm saying is that the claim, the Christian claim, the Orthodox Christian claim at least, the traditional Christian claim, that a morally perfect and just being would believe that an appropriate sort of punishment for people who don't quite love him in the right way, don't quite worship him in the right way, is this kind of eternal suffering. I'm saying that claim is absurd. That just doesn't make any sense to me. Okay? Now, by contrast, if I adopt a view that the doctrine of eternal damnation is a human invention, then I can start to make sense of it. Right? It would serve a couple of functions with regard to the religious system. One function is that it would serve as a kind of scare tactic to keep people in line. You better believe this belief system or else horrible things are going to happen to you. And that's actually a very common tenet of a lot of different religious systems. They have that in there for that reason. But another function is to give you a kind of virtual retribution, right? If you're being mocked and persecuted because of your religious beliefs, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about that, at least nothing you can do that about that in this life, I suppose for some people it's in some way reassuring to hear that those people that are tormenting you because of your religious beliefs are really going to get theirs later on. They're really going to get punished later on. So I can sort of see how people might incorporate that into their belief system because it helps play those different functional roles. But that's not in keeping with a theistic perspective, that's in keeping with an atheistic perspective. So what I'm trying to suggest here is that, as I said earlier, and I think Steve probably agrees with this way of looking at things, two different worldviews. The worldview that strikes me as being the most plausible in terms of explaining these and a variety of other considerations is the atheistic worldview. All right, I'll just stop there.
Very good. I appreciate your journey that you shared with us, your spiritual journey, and I can sympathize with much of it. I have considered all those things too. I also was raised in a religious home, and I had to wrestle with all those things. I was more successful in thinking of reasonable answers to those questions, but I don't deny that they're difficult questions. I'd like to, since I have about 10 minutes for this rebuttal, I'm going to be responding to him. I'm sure his 10-minute rebuttal will be responding to my first presentation also. So, first of all, Bill said that when we are looking for a strategy of belief formation, that believing the testimonies of the biblical writers is not a very wise thing to do, and that it's altogether like believing the claims of the followers of the Buddha or of Islam. Well, to a person who doesn't examine the relative credibility of these sources, that would probably be true, I think. Except when you examine the differences in the claims, you find that it's not equal at all. The Christian scriptures are not comparable at all to the writings of any other major religion in terms of their truth claims. You see, the disciples of Jesus claimed that they spent time with him, that they saw him do these miracles, that they even lost hope after he died. Bill said, you know, when the one you think is the Messiah dies, you can either abandon your faith or you can make up a story that's more encouraging. Well, the disciples of Jesus kind of did, they did abandon their faith. But then they recovered it, not because they made up a story to recover it, because they weren't looking to start a religion. They were fishermen and taxpayers. They weren't religious-type people. They weren't starting a world religion. That wasn't their interest. They were following a man who they thought was going to set them free from their oppressors. If he died and never came back, they would have written him off like they had so many other messiahs that had as many followers as Jesus had, who died and were abandoned by their followers. What's different in this case? What's different in this case is that the disciples of Jesus actually ran into him again. After he died, they saw the holes in his hands and feet. They touched him. They had seen him dead. And they saw him alive again. And therefore, what we have in the Gospels is at least alleged eyewitness testimony. Now, if a Muslim says, I believe the angel Gabriel appeared to Muhammad and gave him the Quran, well, that's a belief, but no one can claim to testify. No one was there. No one claims to have been there. If this happened, it was a private meeting with Muhammad and the angel. Only Muhammad testifies to it, and Joseph Smith testified similar things about the Book of Mormon. There's no external testimony available. There's only religious claims. Likewise, the Buddha sits under a tree, and it's revealed to him the Eightfold Path. If you like his ideas, be a Buddhist. But you can't testify that they're true because they're not based on objective, historical, observable things. The reason that I believe the testimony of the Gospels is a different kind of evidence than that of any other religious writings, is the testimony of the Gospels are, at least allegedly, historical records by eyewitnesses who were there and who were at least willing to die for saying it was true. And there are many Muslims who will die for their faith. This is often pointed out by atheists I've talked to. Well, so what that the disciples died for their beliefs? Many Muslims die for their beliefs. Yes, exactly. Muslims will die for their beliefs. These people died for their testimony. Some people believe things so strongly they'll die for it. But not everyone has seen things and will testify to it. and then will die for it, knowing, you know, claiming something's true that didn't happen. They didn't claim that they believed it. They claimed that they saw it and that they were there and they handled it. So they were either just outright liars who died for something they knew was wrong, and who no one can imagine any motivation for them to start a religion after their hero had died if he didn't rise from the dead, because they never made any money off it. All they got was fed to the lions. What's the motivation for these people? I don't think it's true that the religious claims of the Bible are similar in nature, especially if the Gospels are similar in nature to the beliefs of other religions. I think they stand definitely in a plateau above all others. Now, I like the idea of inference to the best explanation, and the question is atheism the best explanation, even of the things that were talked about? Now, I hadn't brought up the specifics of the Christian faith, but I don't mind them being brought up because I'm very comfortable with them and fairly familiar with them. And I do believe that a person who does not have Judeo-Christian presuppositions will never find the sacrifice of Christ for our sins reasonable. But to suggest that the disciples desperately sought a fictional story about the resurrection and a fictional explanation of the redemption that was through his blood because they were disillusioned and had to think of something quick does not account for the fact that for centuries before them, their ancestors had been offering blood sacrifices looking forward to the ultimate redemption. The disciples didn't make up this idea that the shedding of blood brings redemption. It goes back to the earliest stories of the book of Genesis, even before there was a Jewish religion to practice such things. It's the most ancient practice, and actually Sam Harris, the atheist, says a lot about all the universal practices of ancient, you know, barbaric people to offer blood sacrifices, which he thinks is abominable. But I ask, where did these people all get the idea that blood has some propitiatory power? Well, we would say, that is, moderns would say, it's kind of ugly and bloody and archaic and primitive. But actually, if we're the first generation to come along to think that it isn't true, on what basis do we think it's not true? Not on the basis of science. What scientific discovery has been made in recent times that proves that blood sacrifice doesn't atone for sin? No one denies redemption on the basis of any scientific discovery or any historical discoveries. What we can say is we're just the first generation to come along, or the second, that had a tremendous distaste for the idea. All other people who've ever lived on every part of the planet took for granted that there was something valid in this. We don't in our society. Our culture rejects it. But if we reject it only because it offends our cultural sensitivities, then we're just being xenophobic. We're saying, I don't like it because it's not like my culture. There is no objective reason to deny it. It simply is out of fashion to believe it in our modern Western world. But being out of fashion doesn't make it wrong, and certainly doesn't make it disproved. I personally believe that the blood sacrifice of Christ does redeem us from our sins, and it certainly does not mean that God took the least efficient way of doing it when he could have snapped his fingers and saved us all, because salvation in the Christian point of view... How much time do I got? 1 minute?
4 minutes.
4 minutes, oh good. In the Christian point of view, salvation isn't just grab those people and throw them into heaven. God could do that, except they'd taint heaven. Because he doesn't want heaven to be like this. Do you? When you read the newspapers, you want heaven to be like this? Well, I don't think God does either. What God wants is for heaven to be populated by people who want to love each other, who want to be in harmony with their Creator, who are sorry about the evil things they've done, who need to come to a thing called repentance for the evils they've done to other people. Now, Bill said he didn't think people are all that evil. I may agree with him when he says there's some good and some bad in people. Some Christians don't agree with me about that. Some Christians think that everything's bad about non-Christians, and there's no good in people unless you get saved. But frankly, I've been around saved people a lot, and I don't think there's much good in them either. I think everyone I've met has some good and some bad in them. But that's not what saves you, having a little more good than bad. If you're going to be right with God, there's got to be something that God will do, because we obviously can't, to eliminate the stain of the bad that we've all done. And God says, I'll do that. And I'll do it at my own expense. because you don't have what it takes to pay that price. And that is what Christianity believes. It may not make sense to an atheist who doesn't believe there's a God, doesn't believe that blood atonement makes any sense, but those are more beliefs of a prejudice. And I don't deny I have a prejudice. I do now. But when I was searching for truth, I was raised a Christian. I was raised in a church like he was, but I went through a rebellious stage like most teenagers do. I rethought everything. I threw out lots of things my parents taught me. But when I looked into the claims of Christ, I looked at them objectively and compared them with the claims of other belief systems. I couldn't help but say, I'd be a fool to say this isn't true and to say something else is, because the inference to the best explanation seems to be that the gospel writers were telling the truth. What else could have motivated them to do what they did? There's more I want to say, and perhaps I'll be able to say it later, but on the problem of suffering, of course that's a very nuanced subject. Perhaps in my, I'll have a 5-minute occasion later, maybe I can go into that if nothing draws me somewhere else in his next presentation, but I would like to talk about this question of suffering. Does it agree with the biblical concept of God, or does it agree more with atheistic worldview? I'll talk more about that later, but I think I've just run out of time. So thank you.
Okay, then I want to just say a couple of things about what Steve just said, and then I want to get back to some of his earlier comments. I think Steve and people like Steve sometimes suggest that an atheist like myself, that we're prejudicial against the supernatural. And as a matter of fact, I think that's probably right. I think that, at least on one understanding of what prejudice means, if you're suggesting that I'm predisposed to be highly skeptical of claims of events that violate the laws of physics, or people witnessing things that violate the laws of physics, then yes, I'm skeptical of that. And you know what? So are all of you. Right? If somebody comes to you and says, hey, I spent the afternoon levitating over the Luxor, you would be far more skeptical about that than if the person said, oh, well, I spent the afternoon working on my carburetor. Okay? Now, so he's right that there's a sense in which I believe that claims about supernatural events, I'm very, very, very skeptical about those sorts of claims. And when I was referring to some of the other religious leaders, I wasn't simply talking about claims of particular revelations that they had where nobody else was around. I'm talking about, for example, the Buddha, who tons of witnesses supposedly saw him walk on water. I'm talking about Muhammad, who supposedly witnesses saw him split the moon in half. It's not difficult to go through the historical record and find lots and lots of individuals claiming to be able to have supernatural powers or to do supernatural things, and their followers endorse that. They say, yes, we witnessed that in fact happening. But what's interesting is that most Christians reject all of those claims. They say that doesn't hold up to scrutiny. But in this one case of these individuals living in Jerusalem around 2,000 years ago, you accept it in that case. And I would say that the difference is that my skepticism is fairly consistent. I'm across the board skeptical of claims of supernatural, whereas it seems to me that Christians are often inconsistent. They dismiss it in all these other cases, but accept it right here. As it just so happens, with regard to the beliefs that they quite often were raised with. Now, I didn't quite understand Steve's point about blood sacrifice. I'm perfectly happy to say they didn't just make it up out of thin air, right? That they were motivated to adopt this interpretation because of past traditions and past attitudes about the nature of sacrifice, that influenced them. And I also don't think that they just sat around and said, oh, let's come up with a good story. I suspect that people are capable of telling themselves various things and coming to believe them in various ways. And I'm not suggesting that they didn't really believe these things. I think they did believe them, but it was a psychological process that you go through when you're trying to make sense of a catastrophic, disastrous situation. All right, so that's on the recent stuff. But let me get back to Steve's original claims. What Steve was sort of putting forward was a really famous argument for the existence of God, as you know, called the cosmological argument. And there have been very many different versions of the cosmological argument. If you've ever wondered why is there something rather than nothing, then you've wondered along the lines of the cosmological argument. For traditional versions, like the version that was put forward by Samuel O'Clark and to some degree Aquinas, people would say appeals to something called the principle of sufficient reason. That there has to be a reason for every single fact. Every fact has a reason. And one fact that requires a reason is simply the existence of the universe. Okay? The universe doesn't explain itself, so there's got to be some alternative explanation for the universe, and that explanation is God. Well, first off, notice that doesn't really get you Western theism, right? That doesn't establish an omnipotent, all-powerful, all-knowing being. Even if I concede that there's something that stands outside of the universe, that created the universe, that certainly doesn't give you the God of Western theism. It just gets you some kind of first cause or unmoved mover or something like that. But moreover, I don't believe the principle of sufficient reason. I think it's actually false. I'm perfectly happy believing in just brute facts, that there are certain facts that don't admit of an explanation. Why is it that light travels 186,000 miles per second and not 185,000 miles per second? No explanation. That's just a brute fact about the way things are. Now, the version of the cosmological argument that I think Steve was suggesting is a slightly different version. It's often referred to as the Kalam version of the cosmological argument. It's been put forward by a philosopher of religion named William Lane Craigers, who at least has been recently sort of resurrected by him. And the basic argument goes like this. Everything that has a beginning must have a cause. The universe has a beginning, as demonstrated by the Big Bang. Therefore, there must be something independent of the universe that brought it into existence. And Craig appeals to sort of our everyday understanding of cause and effect relations. Now, I'm not a cosmologist. I don't really understand what the physicists are claiming about what things were like, in some sense, before the Big Bang. Since the Big Bang brought into existence the entire space-time continuum, I find that my normal concepts trying to make sense of that period, they don't really apply very well. It's fairly nonsensical. And the physicists I talk to all say, yeah, that's right. It doesn't really make sense. We really can't make sense. The important point that I want to make, however, is that insofar as this bizarre situation where there's no space and there's no time, it's what some physicists refer to as a quantum epoch or a singularity or something like that. What they tell us is you can't apply your ordinary notions of cause and effect relationships. Right? Our ordinary notions of cause and effect relationships are grounded in things operating within space and time. And what they have suggested, at least some of them have suggested to me, is those ordinary notions of cause and effect relationships don't really make sense when you're trying to make sense of what brought about the Big Bang or what caused the Big Bang. And in fact, some of them have gone so far as to suggest that, as far as we know, the notion of something being self-causing or self-initiating is perhaps the right way to understand what happened with regard to the Big Bang. So I just would say the situation involving the universe prior, in scare quotes, prior to the Big Bang is such a weird and crazy situation that you really can't infer much of anything at all from that. And you're certainly right that some physicists have suggested that really there's a kind of oscillating universe scenario where the universe expands and collapses back into itself and expands and collapses back into itself, and that's what's going to happen. There'll be a future Big Bang down the road and so on. I'm not sure what the physicists say about that nowadays or not, whether or not they endorse that picture. But I would just say I'm very wary of arguments for the existence of God that claim we know the universe had to have a cause in the ordinary sense of a cause because it had a beginning. And I'm wary of that because the situation we're describing isn't our ordinary sense in which something is beginning. It's this very weird situation with regard to quantum physics. How am I doing with time?
2.5 minutes.
Okay. So that is a sort of version of the argument that I think Steve was hinting at, but there was a little bit of another kind of argument for the existence of God that you touched upon, and it's often referred to as the teleological argument. And the teleological argument is due to people like Paley and various others, and that's a suggestion that it's not just the existence of the universe that cries out for an explanation, but instead it's something that we discover in the universe. It's something that we actually find in the universe. And what is it that we find in the universe that requires explanation? Well, in fact, it's not complexity, right? Because we can sort of see how that would come about through natural processes. And it's not simply regularity. For people like Paley, it was the teleology or the functionality that we see in the universe. The things seem to have a design or have some sort of a purpose or have some sort of functional role. Now, that was, I believe, a very compelling argument for believing in God when you focus on the functionality of organisms, right? When you focus on, for example, the obvious function that my heart has, and you see that it's there to pump blood, then it looks like that was clearly designed by somebody. Or another example that I like is this porcupine, right? It's a really slow-moving sort of creature, and you're like, well, geez, how am I going to keep this thing alive? How is it going to survive? I know I'll give it quills. A brilliant defense mechanism. And so I think Dawkins was somebody who, or maybe it was Stephen Jay Gould, who said, prior to Darwin, you could not be an intellectually fulfilled atheist because you couldn't understand this kind of teleology that we see in organisms. And the reason, I think, why evolutionary theory is so controversial is because it gives us an alternative explanation for that kind of design, that kind of teleology that we actually see. It gives us an alternative explanation because we can now understand how it could come about through purely natural processes. Now, this is an argument for not believing in God, right? Lots and lots of Christians and lots of Catholics embrace evolutionary theory, and they view evolution as the mechanism whereby God brings about design. But it does pull the rug out from under one of the more compelling reasons for believing in God. Again, inference to the best explanation argument. What's the best explanation for the design that we see in animals and in organisms? Used to be, there's got to be some kind of a designer. Now, the best explanation is because lots of different pieces of evidence point in favor of it, it's evolutionary theory.
Time.
Okay.
Well, while it's still in my mind, I need to answer just a couple of things that Bill just said, and then try to get back to, if I can, the subject of suffering. What, 4 minutes we have? Oh, I'm not going to get very far. Five, whatever. Okay. First of all, evolution may indeed, some people feel, account for complex structures in the living world, having developed from simple structures in the living world. I'm not convinced that it does, but many people feel it does. Dawkins is the one who said that it was before Darwin it was impossible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Now we can be intellectually fulfilled atheists. Well, once you have a living thing, you can. But Darwin had nothing to say about the origin of life. In fact, except in the original edition of Darwin's Origin of Species, on the last paragraph he said that a divine benevolence put the first living thing here, and then evolution started happening. That's still probably the best explanation an evolutionist can give, because things that are pre-biological don't evolve. Natural selection deals with things that pass on traits genetically to offspring. That's the beginning of evolution. That's a creature has a mutation of some kind, and through its genetics it passes it on, and so there's variation. That variation may lead to more complexity, so says evolution. But you don't have any evolution of any kind until you have a living thing first. I did not argue about anything about evolution. What I argued for is the origin of life and the origin of information, which has to be there before there's a self-replicating molecule. Those things cannot be caused by evolution, because evolution is allegedly caused by those things. Non-living things, non-replicating things don't start. When Dawkins was interviewed by Ben Stein, what was the beginning of life? He says, well, the thing, it was at the first, the origin of the first self-replicating molecule, Dawkins said. Okay, well, and says, well, how'd that happen? Well, that could have been seeded here from creatures or from another planet. Well, that transports the problem to another planet. It doesn't solve the problem. Where did the first self-replicating thing in nature begin? It had to be there before evolution could begin. So I didn't make arguments that evolution can answer. I could. I mean, if I'd gone further, I might have given some arguments that an evolutionist might have his response to, but I didn't get that far. I talked about the origin of life and the origin of information, and both of those things have to be there before there can be any evolution. Bill said he's an equal opportunity skeptic about the supernatural, and so he's equally skeptical about the resurrection of Jesus as he is about Buddha walking on water and about Muhammad splitting the moon. Well, those are not equal things either. Buddha was an ordinary man and never claimed to be anything else. Buddha did not claim to be God. He did not claim to be the Son of God. He didn't claim to be anything special except an enlightened one, awakened one. And the one who is awake is what Buddha means. He's one who had an enlightenment. He doesn't claim to have supernatural powers. And the earliest followers of his didn't claim that either. Later traditions added those in. But likewise, Muhammad was a mere man, but he's a prophet. Prophets sometimes do miracles. But Muhammad was a mere man. And to split the moon is a nonsensical thing to do. When Jesus did miracles, they were consistent with the claims of who he claimed to be and who he, according to those nearest to him, proved himself to be by the resurrection of the dead. And therefore, again, the claims that that Jesus did miraculous things, they may be doubted by a skeptic, but they are not on the same plane with the claims that an ordinary man who never claimed to be anybody special did similar things. It's true in the legends of the followers of these guys, anything can be claimed, but do the claims of specific actions fit the whole identity and the whole worldview that surrounds the man and his general claims? I don't think some of those guys. 1 minute. On the matter of suffering, I can't in 1 minute tell you what I elsewhere have said in 6 hours, only briefly. And I have tapes, I have lectures on making sense out of suffering from a Christian point of view. I can't in 60 seconds do any justice, but perhaps in my three-minute summation I may get to something in that. I doubt it, but maybe in the questions and answers, if I have a moment or two, I can say something more about that. I'm not even going to try to do it justice when I have to cut off in 40 seconds or less. So I'll go ahead and yield the rest of my time to Bill.
Yeah, is this on? Okay.
Now, Steve's absolutely right. He didn't bring up the evolutionary issue. I was just bringing that up in the context of this design argument and sort of how it's fit into the larger sort of thing with regard to different arguments and why that's controversial. Let me talk about the point that he's making with regard to the origin of life. It's true, this is kind of a mystery, how you get basic compounds to combine in such a way that they have the capacity for self-replication. And this is something that a lot of scientists have done a lot of work on recently. Over the last 10 years in particular, there's all these little origin institutes that are cropping up at different universities where scientists, in fact, are working on exactly this kind of problem. And I think right now there's maybe 5 or 6 different theories out there about exactly how this could have come about in the sort of primordial early stages of Earth. What they're beginning to realize is that there are all sorts of ways in which non-organic compounds, non-organic molecules can combine in various ways such that they can start self-replicating. And it's true, it's going to take a certain period of time and the conditions have to be right, but when they consider the sorts of conditions that were there in that primordial stage of the Earth with the right amount of ammonia and the right amount of methane and different sorts of energy sources, people have constructed a variety of different... In fact, there's now a bunch of theories that they think that there's a variety of different ways in which this could have come about, where these non-organic compounds could be combined in ways that would be self-replicating and therefore be life. It's a fascinating area of research. I'm not an expert on it. But suffice to say that most contemporary... I don't know what you chemical biologists, I don't know what you call the people who work in this particular area, are actually quite confident that it is very possible that this could have happened. And I'm actually going to make a prediction. Okay, I'd be willing to bet that within your lifetime or the lifetime of some of you, some of these scientists will actually be able to combine non-organic compounds in such a way that they're self-replicating. In other words, they're going to create life in this way in the laboratory. Okay, so I actually think they're going to figure that out. From what I've read on the subject matter, it seems that they're getting closer and closer to understanding how this could come about. So this idea that it's some sort of kind of deep mystery that we can't make sense of, or that it's a kind of an embarrassment for the atheistic picture, it's just false. It's true. There are a lot of mysteries. There are a lot of things that we don't understand from a scientific perspective. But we can kind of see how the story would go. We can kind of make sense of what actually happened. We can put forward hypotheses and test those hypotheses and discover that, yes, as a matter of fact, given the sorts of conditions that were there, and given that the raw materials that were available, and given a significant period of time, we can see how self-replicating molecules, how nucleotides and those sorts of things could actually come about. We're beginning to understand how that happened. So scientists, as far as I know, they have a different perspective on this today than they did 10, even 15 years ago. They actually think they're going to be able to understand how this actually happened. Not the actual way it may have happened, because there's a variety of different ways it could have happened, but they're going to come up with different hypotheses that are plausible explanations for it, how it actually did happen.
1 minute.
I think I will simply just defer to you if you want to talk about suffering. I know that's an important issue for you, so if you want to talk about that, that's fine.
This isn't technically my rebuttal time, but I do want to say something about the origin of life, because Bill is more confident than many are that the origin of life will be explained scientifically. For example, Antonio Lescano is not confident. Well, who is he? He's only the president of the International Society for the Study of the Origin of Life. The International Society for the Study of the Origin of Life. Antonio Lescano said this: one feature of life, though, remains certain. Life could not have evolved without a genetic mechanism, one able to store, replicate, and transmit to its progeny information that can change with time. Precisely how the first genetic machinery evolved also persists as an unsolved issue. The exact pathway for life's origin may never be known. Imagine if you're making your living, someone's paying you some research grant to discover the origin of life, and you came up and said, we'll probably never know that. And this is after many, many years of studying it. And he's the president of the Society for the Study of the Origin of Life. He doesn't think they're going to ever know it. He said, at least probably. You know, of course, it's very possible, he thinks, but he said it may never be known. So it's easy for me as a non-specialist, or Bill as a non-specialist in these fields, to say, well, I have every confidence that they will someday figure this out. But the guys who are actually working on it don't have that confidence. And the reason is because they need to have, in order to have life, something that reproduces itself. Rocks don't do that. And until you have plants and animals, all you have is minerals and gases. And they don't do that. And so that's the problem that the origin of life studies have run up against from the beginning. Yes, they do hope to explain it. Why? They have to. If they can't find a natural mechanism to create life, then they have to believe the origin of life must be supernatural. And that is against their worldview. That's the one thing that cannot be allowed. And so they have to say, well, we're still working on this thing. And they say, well, we may never find it, but we're still dedicated to finding a natural source of life. Why? Because that's all we're going to allow to exist. We're not going to allow the possibility of something outside nature to exist. Well, too bad. Cut off your own feet if you want to. Why be so close-minded? You see, as a theist, I am simply not that prejudiced. I am simply an open-minded person. I really am. Most religious people are not viewed as open-minded. I would agree. Most religious people probably are not very open-minded. I'm not extremely religious, and one thing I am is open-minded. And that's why I'm willing to consider, if evolution proves to be true, then I will consider that evolution happened. That doesn't mean that I'd have to say that God was absent from it, or that God wasn't involved with it, but I could allow that evolution happened because I'm open-minded. I don't think that evolution of the grand scale sort did happen. I don't think the fossil record will confirm that. And I don't think anything will confirm that, certainly. But
Time.
Okay.
Do you have a response to that?
It sounded to me like the quote you gave, the person was saying, we may not know the actual exact mechanism where it came about, but we can come up with about a half dozen mechanisms where it might have come about. So yeah, fair enough. We don't have the historical record to be able to know which of these many possible mechanisms was the one that led to self-replicating molecules. But from what I understand, for the folks working in this field, they're pretty confident they're going to be able to come up with some. They have a sense of what the mechanisms are. And as I said, mark my words, I bet in your lifetime they will synthesize this process in the laboratory. They will actually go convert inorganic molecules into self-replicating molecules.
Steve, you have 1 minute to ask Bill a question.
Okay. Bill, if in fact that happens, if through immense years of the most intelligent minds in science, sort of backward engineering from what they know about life to something that they can put together artificially and make life, if that does happen, which is not, would that prove that this happened in nature? Or would that simply prove that it takes intelligent design to make that happen?
Okay. Here's what they're up to, it seems to me. Let's recreate the conditions of Earth and recreate the kind of compounds that were there, recreate the same kinds of energy sources that were there, and see what happens. And see what happens. Now, of course, we don't have 50 million years to work, so they may need to fiddle with the process a little bit, to kind of speed things up a little bit, to replicate that kind of variety that would naturally come about over an extended period of time. Okay? So as I understand what they're doing, they are recreating the natural conditions, true, in a laboratory, but they're recreating the natural conditions that bring about a natural phenomenon. It's like when I remember as a kid in the science lab, they would recreate static electricity that is replicating what happens with lightning. Okay? You're recreating, in an artificial setting, the original natural conditions that bring about a natural phenomenon. That's, as I understand, what they're trying to do.
Bill, you have 1 minute to ask Steve a question.
Okay. It's kind of a two-part question, and it gets back to Scripture, I suppose. So, and again, it's kind of keeping on this theme of inference to the best explanation. But if indeed the Bible is divinely inspired, wouldn't you expect to find in it certain scientific facts that people didn't know at that time? Wouldn't you expect there to be some kind of revelation about how the sun is just a star, or that the earth goes around the sun, or that the cause of disease is microorganisms? Wouldn't you expect that information would be relayed? And putting aside just the scientific things, this is the second part, what about moral practices, right? Wouldn't you expect to find that the moral institutions and the moral practices that the people accepted at that time, but that we now recognize as being profoundly immoral, wouldn't you expect there to be some kind of correction of that? I mean, the thing that comes to mind is slavery, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you know the Bible far better than I do. But as I understand it, there are no New Testament passages, or there are no passages that explicitly forbid slavery, and there are a few passages, like in Paul's letter to Timothy, where it seems that slavery is being explicitly endorsed. So, you know, you would think, it seems to me, that if this is indeed inspired by a just and morally perfect being, and he's trying to get the message across, along with commandments about how to worship him, would be included, thou shalt not own slaves. Why is it we don't find something like that in Scripture?
That's two questions, and they both deserve equal length answer, but I can't give them both equal length. About why the Bible doesn't tell us those kinds of scientific facts, I suppose it's because the Bible isn't intending to give us a comprehensive knowledge or even any knowledge of science unrelated to its theme. All books have a subject that they're talking about, and the subject of the Bible is how man got into his present condition and what God has done to get man back to where he needs to be. The astronomy would not be an important issue in that discussion. I could say more, but I don't have time. On the matter of the moral issues, we often object to slavery because we're always thinking of what we call, historians call, Atlantic slavery. Kidnapping black people from their homes, bring them over, abusing them, treating them like chattel, and so forth. All societies had slavery throughout history. That doesn't make it right. But in biblical times, many people would actually sell themselves into slavery because they couldn't pay their debts, and it was a more secure economic circumstance. And the Bible told people who owned slaves to treat them justly, to not abuse them, and in fact, all the instructions concerning slavery have to do with that, about treating your slaves mercifully. The idea of human rights and no one should be owned by anyone else is an ultra-modern idea that we like it, we're raised with it, talk about holding to a belief system because we're raised with it. The idea of human rights certainly does not come out of evolution. An atheistic idea of evolution can't tell you anything about human rights because humans are just the next animal up. The next species better than us can gobble us up with impunity. Actually, I don't really see how evolution without God can pronounce any moral outrage against anything, since evolution is caused by the strong preying upon the weak. If human beings who are strong prey upon the weak, that's just, who's to say it's immoral? That's how we got here, according to evolution. That's how our ancestors brought us here, and it may be the way that we're bringing on the next better species. Morality is entirely arbitrary to the atheist, it seems to me. It may be utilitarian, but it isn't really moral in the sense of people ought not to do such a thing just because it's wrong. We might say people ought not to do such a thing because it's unpleasant to other people. But a person who doesn't believe in a God can say, well, what the heck do I care what's unpleasant to other people? This is survival of the fittest here. This is natural selection. I'm stronger than you. I can enslave you. I can kill you. I can steal from you. I can sleep with your wife. You know, who can say I shouldn't? Isn't that how our ancestors brought us here?
Time.
All right.
Steve, you have 1 minute for Bill?
Oh, okay. I guess, Bill, I'd be curious to know what it would take to convince you that there is a God. This is something that Anthony Flew, the former atheist who recently became a deist, as I mentioned, he said he'd like to ask his atheist friends, what would it take? You see, he was an atheist for a long time because, for philosophical reasons, but he said he took his atheist position before the Big Bang cosmology came along and before they knew about molecular biology, what they know now. He said when he saw those things, his atheism went to pieces and he had to rethink it all, and eventually he ended up believing there must be a God of some kind because of that. And he asked his fellow atheists, and I'll ask you, what would it take to convince you that there's a God, if there is one?
About a million different things I can think of. Jesus appearing right here before us right now. You levitating off the ground. Me walking outside the church, looking in the sky and seeing the stars arranged in a way that says, hey, Ramsey, I exist. Any of those sorts of things where there's clear-cut evidence of something that I can't explain from an atheistic, naturalistic perspective would be, for me, compelling evidence. And so, actually, this is leading to the question I'm going to get to you in a minute, but let me just say, sort of in fairness, I don't find a lot of the arguments and a lot of the different pieces of evidence very compelling, but there is actually one argument for the existence of God that I actually do think is really interesting, and it's related to one you brought up. It's called the fine-tuning argument.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're interested in intelligent design arguments, I think this is actually a more interesting sort of argument. It has to do with the fact that if you look at the basic parameters of physics, it looks like they had to be just perfectly tuned a certain way, like the gravitational constant and the strong and weak force. And if they were slightly different, matter would not coalesce in a way that would allow for intelligent life to come about. Now, those are sort of controversial claims. Physicists dispute them. But it looks like that's a pretty good argument. And I find that actually quite interesting. I find that quite compelling. Unlike a lot of the other arguments, it strikes me, especially the other intelligent design arguments, that one actually strikes me as an interesting, compelling argument. I don't think it ultimately works. I think it has problems. But I think an atheist has to think about it to see what's wrong with that particular argument. But at least in terms of observational evidence or particular events, I can think of a ton of different things that could happen that would cause me to become a theist. And as a matter of fact, that leads right into my question to you, which is, why does God make your life so difficult? In the sense that, why does God make it so difficult for you to actually be able to convince someone like me that he exists? Why does he stay hidden? Right? Why not bestow upon you supernatural powers such that you could call a press conference and have Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and me and all the media there and then perform something, get all the scientists there, perform something that is inexplicable from a naturalistic perspective? Now, when I ask theists quite often, it suggested to me that, well, that's really tacky, that God wouldn't sort of stoop to doing that. But you're familiar with the story of Elijah, right? Where Elijah said something like this. He said, well, you know, let's figure out who's got it right. There are the prophets of Baal, and there's me. I'm the prophet of Jehovah. And I'll tell you what, let's put out there an altar, and whoever can cause the altar to burst into flames is telling the truth. Well, that's very much like an empirical test. That's very much like a scientific test. And so apparently in that situation, God felt that it was perfectly acceptable to accommodate Elijah in that situation to convince people that he was in fact the true God. Well, why doesn't he do that for you, basically? Why do you think God stays silent on this issue?
I think there's several parts to that answer, one of which is, on the one hand, that kind of display of force would seem to overwhelm people's resistance to faith. And, I mean, one might think that people would have no choice but to believe if such a thing was done. And that's probably true for some people. Some people probably would. But on the other hand, on the other extreme, it wouldn't do any good for others. Because seeing is not necessarily believing. If I did any kind of a magic trick, I mean, magicians do it here in casinos all the time. Things that I think, that must be real magic. But I know it's not, because I can't figure out how he did it. But someone would say, but that can be figured out. And that's right. No matter how stupendous something appears, the skeptic can always deny it. C.S. Lewis said that he only knew one woman, only met one woman, who ever claimed to have seen a ghost. And he said, the interesting thing is that she didn't believe in ghosts before she saw it, and she didn't believe in ghosts after she saw it. She thought it was a hallucination, proving one thing, that seeing is not believing. You believe what you are willing to believe, and you do not believe what you're not willing to believe. For example, you believe in things I can't possibly believe in. You believe that the first self-replicating molecule, made up of many complex parts containing lots of genetic information, very complex information, put itself together without a designer. To me, that's a miracle. There's certainly nothing in nature to suggest that such a thing could ever happen. And so we believe our own amazing things, depending on what we're willing to believe. I'm open-minded enough to believe that miracles can happen, but I don't believe that God is obligated to do miracles at our command. In Christianity, unlike some forms of television Christianity, in real Christianity, God does miracles when he wants to, and that's pretty darn seldom. Even in the Bible, very seldom were miracles done. There's a lot of them, but they're clustered around three different epochs over a period of 4,000 years. They're not all the time. They're very rare. And likewise, they're very rare now, it would appear. I realize that television Christianity makes us command God to do miracles, and he has to heal us, he has to do things. That's not real Christianity, and it certainly isn't the God of the Bible. Oh, I have a question too, huh? Wow, I wrote down a question for you that now I'm having a hard time finding it here. Too bad. One thing I wondered about is that, did your move toward atheism, did it in any way, was it affected by negative experiences that you had with religious people? Or, if not initially, has it been more strengthened, your commitment to atheism, confirmed by the behavior of religious people?
I would say initially no, but I certainly agree that the level of hypocrisy and the sort of different sort of historical understanding of different sorts of atrocities that have been committed in the name of religion didn't exactly make it seem more appealing to me. Mm-hmm. That's certainly true. Now, I mean, this is actually something that's getting discussed a lot these days. Historically, there certainly have been a number of horrendous things that have been committed in the name of religion, and I think Steve would agree that, yes, but that doesn't demonstrate that religion is false. That just means that some people abuse religion, and I think to some degree you can say the same thing about atheists, people like Stalin and things like that. But it does seem to me that there is the following difference. If you have a religious document or you have a religious text that basically says that people who don't accept this religion are bad people, they're very bad people, then it's a fairly short step from that belief to they need to be destroyed or they need to be eliminated. And I don't see that going the other way with regard to atheism. There's nothing about, well, there really isn't any kind of straightforward atheistic document or doctrine or anything like that. But there's nothing in atheism that suggests that people who believe in God are really bad, evil people, and they need to be destroyed, they need to be eliminated. So at least in terms of the link between belief systems and that a potential abuse and for violence and things like that, I think that there's a much stronger link between theism on the one hand and that violence than going the other way. I do believe that's the case. But no, initially it was not through bad experiences. And in fact, some of my best friends and some of the best people I know are deeply religious individuals. Some of my best friends at Notre Dame were priests. So I certainly recognize that it actually goes both ways.
Last question for Steve.
Okay. I just kind of want to ask the same kind of question you asked me. It's kind of a two-parter, but is there any particular observation or anything that we could discover that would cause you to abandon your faith, that would cause you to become an atheist? And the second part is, with regard to the arguments against theism, I realize that you find none of them convincing, but I'm curious, just out of curiosity, which one keeps you awake at night? Which one do you worry about the most?
The truth of the matter is, in reading atheist books and even hearing your presentation today, I have not heard any arguments that I consider to be against theism. I have heard many arguments against religion. And I would have to put a finer point on that, against bad religion. And there's bad religion. In fact, many of the atheist writers seem to imply that since some religions make people do very bad things, that those religions must be bad religions. I wonder if the reverse would be true. A religion that makes people do really good things, would they say that's a really good religion? Would they recognize there's goodness in it?
Harris on Jainism.
Harris talks about Jainism, right. And he does say positive things about Jainism. But he obviously is not going to convert. Mm-hmm. Right. And I'm sure he doesn't believe any of it's true, you know. But that's a good point. I mean, Sam Harris in his book, Letter to a Christian Nation, does say positive things about the peaceful ethics of Jainism. But your question about would any observation make me change my views about God, and what I'd have to say is my views are always in flux. I never did camp out on just one position. I've changed my theological views many times. I have always remained within the theistic camp, but not because I've predefined those borders. I haven't decided somewhere I'm going to be a theist no matter what. I can change anything else, but I can't change that. To change from being a theist to an atheist, I would have to observe things that would be as convincing to me as the kinds of evidence that someone would have to present to tell me that all of my life has been a dream of an alien. You know, in other words, that God, that I don't exist. And I realize that sounds crazy to a person who doesn't believe in God for me to say. And I cannot explain to you how God has been proven in my life. I hate to use an illustration that will offend the religious and offend the atheist both, but I sometimes think this way, and it's an illustration that really does come from the Bible, although people will be shocked. But, and that is that I sometimes, when I talk to an atheist or hear the arguments of atheists, I feel like a man who is happily married and has an intimate sex life with his wife, listening to a man who never got to first base with a woman and who says, therefore, there's no such things as orgasms. And the man says, oh, there really are. No, I just don't believe it. I have these arguments against it. Well, I don't care how many arguments you have against it. You're going to have to go further than that to convince me there's no such thing as that. And the truth of the matter is, the reason I say there's biblical reason for that illustration is that God compares his relationship to his people with the intimate relationship of a man and a woman. And I do believe that it's an interpersonal thing that cannot be communicated in its entirety from one person to another. It can be, one can try to explain it, one can try to show that it's rational to believe it, but what one knows from firsthand experience and relationship is something that is not transmittable and is only to be found when someone says, okay, the evidence is adequate for me to look into this and to seek it out and to find out if it's true. Tom. I have done that. And because I did that, it would take an awful lot to move me from that. I can't imagine what could. Yeah.
3 minute conclusion, Bill.
Oh, okay. I probably won't take 3 minutes. Look, let me just reiterate my appreciation for you having me here this evening and the open-mindedness that you've displayed. Look, in certain ways, America's kind of this interesting experiment where the question is, can we get people with radically different religious views to live together without killing one another? And I think actually Americans have done a pretty good job on that score. And I think one of the reasons is because of things like this evening, where we choose to talk to one another rather than hate one another. I think that's a good thing. And so I do really appreciate that. There's been a lot of talk recently about the new atheism. There's all these books coming out, Dawkins and Harris and Dennett and various other folks. As far as I can see, there's really nothing new about the atheism. It's the same kinds of arguments that have been around for some time. The atheism itself isn't new. What's actually new is that people are actually buying these books. They're actually reading these books for the first time. And it seems to me that right now in our culture, there's a certain openness to atheism that wasn't there before. And I think, of course, that that's a good thing. But it's still the case that of the different religious perspectives that are out there, atheism is the one where it's still fairly okay to be openly hostile. I think in a recent poll of Americans, something like 85% of Americans said they would never, ever vote for a political leader who doesn't believe in God. If I ever have a son and my son adopts my religious views, he won't be allowed to join the Boy Scouts because atheists aren't allowed in the Boy Scouts. Now, imagine if that was the case with regard to Judaism or Christianity. I think people would be outraged about that. But in any event, what I've tried to do this evening is to just try to, using 70s terminology, give you a sense where someone like me is coming from, so that you can sort of see the perspective and what motivates somebody like me to be an atheist. And I guess finally, the last point that I want to make is that although this evening was largely about disagreement, it's also important to keep in mind the amount that we probably agree on and the amount that we concur on. We both, I'm sure, agree that any form of violence in the name of religion or in the name of anti-religion is a bad thing and intolerable. And I suspect there are other things that we agree upon as well. I suspect, I haven't talked to you about this, but my hunch would be that Steve, like me, is distressed by the degree to which our culture sort of celebrates greed and wealth and excess when at the same time other people in the world are in a tremendous amount of need. I'm driven to the idea that we need to be doing more to help those people, but I'm driven by secular arguments. Steve's probably driven by religious arguments. But we come to the same basic conclusion, and I think that's important to keep in mind as well. So I'll just stop there.
I want to begin by saying I have really enjoyed interacting with Bill. He's very pleasant and very intelligent and a very good spoil for the debate. It is true that we have some things in common, and a lot of those things would be our ethical understanding of things. What we don't have in common is a common basis for having an ethical understanding of things. I do agree that violence and war are horrendous things, though if I didn't believe in God and if I only believed in evolution, I would have to say, but isn't that really what it's all about? Isn't the powerful preying upon the weak, isn't that really what nature is about? Isn't that how we all got here? How can I pronounce against it? How can I stand outside of that which created us all and say, that's not good anymore? It was good then, but it's not good now. I can be against greed and covetousness and all that because I do have an ethic that I'm informed from, I would say from our Creator, that those are things that He does not wish for us to value. But if I didn't know of a Creator, if it was just every man for himself, the survival of the fittest, then for me to accumulate all I can and starve out everyone else there'd be no transcendent ethical objection that could be made to it. Everyone could say that's very selfish of you, but I could say, well, why should I care whether you think I'm selfish or not? Isn't it the selfish gene in me? Isn't that kind of what it's all about, really? Is selfishness and praying, the strong praying on the weak, that's all we really have if we don't have a Creator, because the only alternative to a Creator that we know of is evolution. And if evolution is the answer instead of the Creator, then there is no moral high ground that we can stand on to criticize anyone's ethics or anyone's behavior. In fact, those that act the most like nature, which is bloody in tooth and claw, are the ones who are most aligned with nature, most aligned with reality. We have civilized ideas. That where'd we get them from? where do we get the idea of human rights or animal rights? You know, someone said, you know, one of the biggest problems we have with animal rights is we can't convince the animals to observe animal rights. We're the first species to come up with the idea that lesser animals have rights. Why? Because something is, we have a soul. We have a spirit. Because we were made and informed by a mind and a spirit who cares about things and has let us know in many respects what he cares about. Some of these, some of this knowledge is intuitive. And some of it is, we would say, revealed in, you know, holy scriptures and so forth. As far as whether the Bible is the correct holy scriptures or not, I am fully convinced that it is. I'd be prepared to give many arguments for that, but I don't have time for that. That's another debate. But I truly thank Bill for being here, and thank you so much for coming. Very good. Very good.
Is there anybody here that might have a question for Bill? I'm going to take three questions. They've got to be short, no lectures, no speeches, just a short, concise. If you'll come up to this microphone over here, if you'll get behind him over there, and sir, you next. How about for Steve? Any questions for Steve? You two? For Steve? Okay, over at this microphone over here, please. Go ahead.
All right. Kind of leading into what he had mentioned, my name is Jay, and I appreciate both of you. I think it was a very nice debate, very cordial, and very educational. My question for you tonight kind of leads to what he had mentioned about, as an atheist, how do you really define sin in your life? Where does the definition come from, and how do you apply it to your life? And would each atheist have the same agreement on what the definition of sin would be?
Okay, good. I don't believe in sin because, as I understand sin, it has a uniquely theological meaning, that it's to do something that violates God's laws, and since I don't believe in God's laws, I don't believe in sin. However, I do believe in immorality and morality, that kind of distinction, and since Steve was talking about it, let me talk about that for a little bit. The truth of the matter is that that's a major area of philosophy, doing ethical theory and coming up with different accounts of what it is about a particular act that bestows upon it its moral status. What is it about a certain act that makes it either morally right or morally wrong? And there's a lot of different work on that. There's a lot of different theories about that. The truth of the matter is virtually none of them appeal to God. There is, in fact, one moral theory that's out there called divine command theory that does appeal to God. It was endorsed by a former colleague of mine at Notre Dame, Phil Quinn, for example. But a lot of people don't think it works. And let me give you a couple of reasons why that is. In fact, a lot of Christian ethicists don't think it works. And here's a couple of reasons. They go all the way back to a famous Platonic dialogue called the Euthyphro. And in the Euthyphro, Socrates asks, is something wrong because God forbids it? Or does he forbid it because he sees that it's wrong? Right. You see the difference between the two cases? Now, divine command theory says it's the former. Well, there's a couple of problems with that. If you believe that, let's say, torturing an innocent child is wrong simply because God commands it, then there would be no guidance for God's commands. He just willy-nilly decides to command this and to allow this over here. And God could have just as easily commanded us to torture innocent children. You say, that's the really good thing to do. Now, you might be tempted to say to yourself, well, wait, God would never command us to torture innocent children. But why not? Right? Because according to divine command theory, torturing innocent children is not wrong until God makes a decree about it. It doesn't have any moral status until then. So it puts this arbitrariness into morality that even a lot of Christian ethicists don't like, that a lot of people would say if you've got a moral theory such that it could turn out to be the case that torturing innocent children is the morally right thing to do, you got a bad moral theory. But let me point out another problem, and this is the one that really bothers Christian ethicists. It seems to make God's own moral goodness a completely uninteresting trait about him. Because notice what it's claiming. It's claiming that moral goodness is whatever God wants. So when you say that God is morally good, all you're really saying is that he wants what he wants. Let me give you an analogy. Let's suppose that there's some tyrant, some leader, and that leader has decreed that anything he wants is legal. So whatever he does is, by definition, in this land, automatically legal. He can steal, he can take whatever he wants, he can kill people, but by definition, it's legal. Now suppose a historian is trying to reflect on what kind of a leader this person was, and suppose a historian says, well, you got to admit he never broke the law. You got to admit he always did what was legal. Well, in that situation, the fact that what he did was legal is completely uninteresting, because anything he did was by definition legal. So too now with regard to God's morality. If you simply define morality as whatever God wants, whatever he decides upon, then the claim that God is morally perfect, or the claim that God is a uniquely moral individual, becomes a completely uninteresting feature of him. Because all you're actually saying is, he wants what he wants. So, the bottom line is that there's a number of different ethical theories out there. Utilitarianism is one of them that claims that the moral status of an act depends upon its consequences. Does it cause suffering? Or does it cause happiness? I think all of us are actually, when you think about when you're really confronted with a difficult moral dilemma, how do you think about what to do in that situation? My guess is a lot of you engage in utilitarian reasoning. You ask yourself, will this cause harm to somebody? Will this cause suffering? What will the consequences be? Notice that's how we justify so many of our actions. We justify, for example, the war in Iraq by saying, yes, it's bad, but in the long run, it'll bring about more good things. We focus on the consequences. Well, that's a very compelling moral theory, and it makes no mention to God. It's not relativism. It doesn't say that we just make up morality willy-nilly. It's claiming, no, there's a specific feature that a given act has which bestows upon it its moral status, and that's its consequences. So that's, I think, how an atheist thinks about not sin so much, but right and wrong.
Time.
No, sure.
We can both respond to both questions, yeah. Yeah, I would say that my concept of what's morally right and wrong is not so much based on divine decree as divine character. And that everything that God said is wrong are things that are contrary to his character. That is who he is by nature. Now, it so happens that his character is revealed to be dominated by justice, mercy, faithfulness, and love. Now, if God had been a devil instead and was, you know, characterized by injustice, cruelty, and lying, and so forth, I guess there wouldn't be much we could say about it. We'd have to live with that. But we can count ourselves fortunate that the God who made us happens to be committed to things like justice and mercy and so forth. And therefore, every command that he says is good is an embodiment in action of an ideal that is in his character. And everything that he says is evil is the embodiment of an action embodying something that's quite contrary to his character. That would be my take on it.
You have a question for Steve?
Yes, my question has a origin of life direction. And it's, how does the fairly common occurrence of errors within self-replication, such as cancers, lend itself to intelligent design?
Well, it depends on whose version of intelligent design you have. If you're looking at Christian theology, which would be where I come from, we believe that God made all things perfect, and therefore there was no direction for them to go but down from there. And there was a downward slide called the fall, that the fate of the universe, well, not the universe, but the fate of the earth, was put into the hands of the original people. And by their wrong choices, they incurred consequences on the whole creation, which have been thorns and thistles and sorrow and grief and things like that. In other words, negative things began to come in, and that the degeneration of that which was once perfect is what we would expect to see. We would not expect to see something that was created originally imperfect but became more perfect as a result of a fall, but rather that the intelligent designer really did intelligently design. Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and others have pointed out that there are lots of examples of unintelligent design. For example, they talk about newts, salamanders that live their whole life underground, and they have eyes that are blind from birth. They can't see. And they say that's because they evolved from creatures that had eyes that could see. Well, maybe they did. If so, that makes my point. The original design could see. It was not an unintelligent design. What we see today is a degeneration from it, which is exactly what a Christian theologian would expect to see. At least it's the direction we would expect to see things go. That sickness and handicap and mutations, by the way, it's hard. Geneticists would be hard-pressed to find one mutation that is unambiguously beneficial to the organism, but they can find mutations by the truckloads that are dangerous and damaging to the organism. So I would say that mutation is simply part of the whole process of degeneration that's now a part of nature. We could even say the law of entropy, although I think some forms of entropy must have been present even before the fall.
Time.
Yeah. Thank you, though.
I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, I would think that from the standpoint of the virus, the way they mutate to avoid drugs is pretty beneficial for the virus, and we know that that happens on a pretty regular basis. So we actually are aware of different sorts of mutations that are actually adaptive for the organism. But, this business about how nature is a tinkerer and it's sort of it puts together what it can in terms of evolutionary processes. The famous example of Stephen Jay Gould's is the panda's thumb, mm-hmm. where it's actually a part of the wrist bone, but there was selection pressure for the panda needing the thumb, so this eventually migrated. And it doesn't work very well, but it works okay. It does a pretty good job. And for Darwin, that was indeed part of the evidence for evolution, was the fact that there was so much poorly designed stuff in us. And so I think that that's actually, you know, any evolutionary textbook would be filled with examples of exactly that kind of thing. There's a great movie you mentioned,
Ben Steinman.
Yeah, the Ben Steinman. There's another really fun movie I'd recommend called Flock of Dodos, if you haven't seen it. And it was all about the Dover trial and what took place there. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty middle of the road. It's not really taking sides so much. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of discussion in that movie about how in the animal kingdom we see so many things, so many types of stomachs and things like that just really don't make sense. They're not what you'd expect to find if an intelligent God decided to just create these things whole cloth, but they make perfectly good sense if you see how this came about through this sort of accidental but guided accidental process of evolution.
Done.
Question for Bill?
Yeah, I would like to express my appreciation to Bill for an atheist to come into a largely Christian setting and face an audience that's probably mostly against your position, I think that's commendable.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Now my question. One of the most convincing proofs for me that the Bible is divinely inspired is the fact of predictive prophecy. There were approximately 300 prophecies from the Old Testament to the new about the Messiah. None of them have proved to be false. Now, some have yet to be proved in the future. They're still out there. But zero of them have been false. Two that I want to bring up now, Micah chapter 5, prophesies that the Christ child will be born in Bethlehem. And that was prophesied 700 years in advance. The second one I want to bring up is Isaiah chapter 7 that prophesies the Christ child will be born of a virgin, which is extremely rare. Both of those prophecies did come true hundreds of years after the prophecy was made. How would you respond to that?
Okay, well, I am not in anywhere near Steve's league in terms of biblical scholarship, but what little I know about it is what I can use to try to respond to you. To begin with, given that the story of Jesus' life was written years after his death by people who wanted to present him as the Messiah, it seems to me that it's not terribly surprising that they describe his life in such a way that he fulfills certain sorts of prophecies. That would be a fairly easy thing to do. And in fact, I think as Harris points out, one of the examples of exactly that, one of the pieces of evidence that was what was going on, was that in one of the Gospels, I don't know quite who it was, which ones it was, but they mistranslated, or they basically are making their claims about the virgin birth based upon a mistranslation of, I think, the very Isaiah passage, where the original Hebrew is actually saying maiden, young woman, not virgin. And so their depiction of Jesus as coming from a virgin birth seems to actually not fulfill the prophecy, but instead is based upon a Greek mistranslation of the original Hebrew. All right, but let me make a more general point. And again, I'm not a biblical scholar, but as far as I understand things, there are a lot of Jewish scholars who would claim that, as a matter of fact, Jesus does not fulfill the prophecies, that the prophecies were mistranslated by Christians, that in certain passages where it seems to be referring, that the Christians say are referring to the suffering of Christ, they're really referring to the nation of Israel as a whole. Maimonides, I'm sure you're familiar with him, is somebody who says if you really want to ask about which prophecies does Jesus' life best fulfill, it's those prophecies about false prophets. It's those prophecies about somebody who will claim to be the Messiah and then die, and then later die. So, at least from the standpoint of Jewish scholarship, they would claim that, as a matter of fact, the life of Christ does not fill those Old Testament prophecies. Time. But again, I'm not an authority.
On the matter of Isaiah 7:14, the virgin shall conceive and bring forth a son. It's true that in the Hebrew, the word virgin is alma, which apparently can simply mean a young woman without any reference to her virginity. But almost 300 years before the New Testament was written and before Christ was born, the Old Testament was translated by the Jewish scholars in Alexandria into Greek, into a book that's called the Septuagint. And it is the book that was used by the New Testament writers primarily. They translated the word alma as parthenos, which in the Greek does mean a virgin. So the question then is, did the Alexandrian Jewish scholars make a mistake by identifying the meaning of alma with the meaning of parthenos, or actually were they more in touch than we are with the way the word alma was nuanced in their time, in ancient times? That's an open question that theological liberals and theological conservatives will probably always debate, but that is a problem that some people bring up. The main thing is, I agree with you that many, many prophecies of the Old Testament were fulfilled by Christ. And in an argument of this sort, I wouldn't bring up the virgin birth for the simple reason that an opponent could say, well, I don't believe that Jesus was born of a virgin. Who can prove it? Who witnessed it? You know, I believe it. I believe in the virgin birth. But a skeptic could say that's not a very good example because no one can verify it. But there were many things in the life of Jesus that were publicly verified, that were predicted. And to suggest that either Jesus himself or his biographers doctored the story, either Jesus did things deliberately in order to seemingly fulfill prophecy, or his biographies claimed that he did, doesn't really work very well. For one thing, Jesus never appears to be trying to convince anyone that he was the Messiah. We only have three times in his whole teaching that he ever mentioned that he was Messiah. Two of them were in private conversations, one with the woman at the well, one with his disciples at Caesarea Philippi, and one was at his trial when he was asked, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And he said, I am. But he never went around preaching publicly, I am the Messiah, nor did he try to convince anyone that he was. And if he was trying to, he would have behaved differently, because the Jews did not expect the Messiah to do what he did. That's why the Jewish scholars don't think he fulfilled the prophecies. They were looking for a different kind of Messiah. They understood the prophecies differently. If Jesus was a charlatan trying to mimic the Jewish expectation of Messiah, he would have come in a more militaristic way, which all the Jews would have said, that's what we're looking for. Instead, he did fulfill prophecies that the Jews weren't paying attention to, but which were the right thing. And he didn't engineer that. Many of them had to do with where he was born, what people would do to him, and not things that a man could engineer for him.
But what about this, the overriding sort of whole point of the Messiah is to return the kingdom of Israel, that did not happen? I mean, it seems like it's at least a bit of a stretch to say that he fulfills these messianic prophecies, given that sort of the main thing didn't happen.
Well, again, Christians believe that was misunderstood by the Jews, that the Israel that those were to be fulfilled to was the faithful remnant of Israel, who happened to become the followers of the Messiah, as well as any Gentiles who might want to join them. Because even in the Old Testament, Gentiles were allowed to join Israel if they wished. So that there was a spiritual kingdom that he came to bring as a precursor to the ultimate universal kingdom that he would bring at his second coming. I realize any skeptic could say, well, that's an interpretation of convenience for Christians. But again,
I'm not an expert on the Bible, but I'm not an expert on anything as much as I'm an expert on the Bible. And I would say that having considered those things, I feel they're fairly compelling to a person like me. Thank you.
You have a question for Steve?
My question's on suffering. I know you didn't get to
Thanks for bringing that up. Yes.
Talk about it, uh-huh. but it's a question by example, so I feel like you should be able to answer it.
Sure.
Recently in news, there was another story where a woman for her entire life was held in captivity by her father.
Yes.
Forced into incest, raped, forced to bear his children, lived pretty one of the most...
Actually, by a kidnapper.
Not Elizabeth Smart. No, there was another case where it was her actual father.
Okay, go ahead.
We can just still imagine mm-hmm. situations in which this horrible kind of torture
sure.
occurs for someone's entire life. This went on for over 20 years. It seems that the Christian doctrine on suffering with these kind of examples says something like, while that's really bad, she will be accepted into heaven, and that'll make up for it. Do you as a human being feel that you can apply the same kind of logic? That is, if this person was, say, your neighbor, and you knew that she was being held in captivity, would you feel comfortable saying, well, I know I could easily report this to the police, but I know that she'll be accepted into heaven, so I'm just going to let God take care of that one?
No, because we have a mandate as Christians to speak up for the abused and for the oppressed and to do what we can to help. Christians and all people know that there are limits to how much of the evil of the world they can stop. And Christians, of course, take a step that non-Christians are not willing to take, and that is to believe that what we are unable to stop, God is permitting for a purpose that He alone understands. Now, that sounds like a cop-out, but it's quite consistent with our worldview. Our worldview is that we are all very highly ignorant creatures compared to the God who made us, and that we are not really aware of His plan except insofar as He reveals it, and that He has revealed much of it, but much of it He has not. And suffering to us, we can see it only on the plane of the immediate. And if God does permit suffering and does choose to reward people, let's say martyrs, in another life for their sacrifice, Christians believe it's worth it. God's not a poor economist. He would not make us pay such a price if the reward was not worth the price it was paid. Even though some of these people are paying the price unwillingly, we don't know how God will handle all those cases, but I will say that it reminds me of a couple of years ago, my teenage son broke his arm. He was in a skateboarding accident, broke his arm, and it was an ugly matter, and it took a while for the emergency room to get around to him, as is so often the case. By the time they got to him, his arm had to be rebroken. And they asked my permission. The doctor, do you mind if I re-break your son's arm? Well, he was in enough pain already. I didn't want to inflict more pain. I wanted to say, no way, don't break my son's arm. You fix him, you know, fix him without breaking him. But I actually asked my son, how do you feel about it? He said, go for it. And so I said, yeah, okay, break his arm. Now, I think sometimes, suppose my son had been 3 years old instead of 17 and I had to make the same decision. There's no way he could have understood the wisdom. Why is my dad letting this horrible pain be inflicted upon me while he stands by and doesn't stop it? Well, I know why I'm doing it, because I don't want him to grow up crooked. I want him to be fixed. But I happen to know that he's broken in a certain way that can't be fixed without further pain. And I believe that in God's economy, all suffering is intended by God to be, at least potentially, therapeutic in the eternal sense. Not all people get the benefit from it because they don't respond to it in a proper way. But I have suffered a few pains in my life too. And I wonder why. Why did I have to go through this particular pain? But it's never crossed my mind that God couldn't have a better purpose than I could imagine for me to go through it. And you know, the hardest things I've been through, I've never been tortured and raped for years and so forth, but the hardest things I've been through have been excruciating at the time. And I can say, looking back, you know, not only in eternity, but even now, I'm a more mature person. I've gained from it. But I'm not saying everyone gains from it.
Time.
I'm saying that God wants suffering to be potentially therapeutic. It doesn't always turn out that way because of human responses to it. Sorry, I can't do better than that. Too little time. Thank you, though, for your question.
I mean, the analogy breaks down, right? I mean, a couple of analogies break down. I mean, the analogy where we've gone through trials and tribulations and we wind up being better because of it. We feel like we're stronger because of it. That's not the kind of suffering that brings up the problem. The kind of suffering is where you go through a horrific battle with cancer and then you die. Or you're, like I said, with a small child, he's burned to death over 80% of his body, suffers for a while, and then dies, where there's no clear benefit to it at all. That's the kind of suffering.
No benefit visible to us.
Yeah, visible to us. Now, so what about this idea that, well, maybe there's some good that comes of it? The philosophers have a name for that. It's called the parent analogy. It's exactly the kind of analogy that you made. But again, the analogy completely breaks down. Because in your situation, the only way you could bring about your son's arm being straightened in the proper way was to inflict this pain upon him by breaking it again. But let's not forget, God is omnipotent. He can do anything. He doesn't have to break arms to straighten them out. He doesn't have to inoculate us. If he wants us to not suffer, he can bring that about simply by willing it. So the analogy breaks down because, unlike with God, we're limited in our abilities, and the only way you can do some things that'll bring about greater good down the road is by inflicting some suffering, like inoculating a child or breaking the arm. But that's not God's problem. God doesn't have that problem because he could bring about whatever end he wants by simply willing it.
I disagree, but I can't answer. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I do have a question for both, but I'll start with this. Okay. Dr. Ramsey, just a clarification on atheism. Because there tends to be different degrees of atheism as well as with theism, I came across the definition that atheist is one that not only disbelieves in the existence of God, but believes that there's proof against the existence of God. To be fair, I'm just wondering if that's the viewpoint that you take, and also, if so, what do you believe the strongest evidence against God would be?
Yeah. I mean, it seems that you're right that there's different sorts of mechanisms of support for either theism or atheism. So you might, for example, simply be an atheist because you believe there's absolutely no good reasons for theism and leave it at that. You don't think that perhaps there are these really strong, compelling arguments against theism. You just don't think there's any real support for theism. I think most atheists actually adopt both views. They don't think that the arguments in favor of theism are very compelling. And on top of that, using what I discussed earlier, kind of the inference of the best explanation, there are some features of the world that are embarrassing to the theist, that don't really make sense within a theistic framework. In other words, let's take the suffering that exists in the world, that's evidence against the existence of a benevolent, loving, all-powerful, and all-knowing God. So I think actually most atheists sort of go both ways. The arguments in favor of God aren't any good, and moreover, there's some compelling reasons for actually believing God doesn't exist. Can I just say one more point on this point? Because another thing that often comes up is the distinction between atheism and agnosticism. And I thought that maybe that's where you're going with this. I just wanted to touch on that because I think there's been a fair bit of confusion on that topic as well. A lot of times agnosticism will be defined as anybody who thinks that maybe God exists but they're not sure. Or maybe they think that God doesn't exist but there's some doubt there. Okay, well, I actually think that if you think that God exists but you're not 100%, then you're just a theist who has some doubts. And if you think that God doesn't exist, but you believe you might be wrong, it's possible that you could be mistaken, then you're an atheist who just realizes that, like a lot of the other things you believe, you could be wrong. My view is that agnostics are really right in the middle. You know, here's 100% certainty that God exists. Here's 100% certainty that God does not exist. There are some people who really could just go either way. They're right in the middle, and they just don't know what to believe. And I think that's actually the proper way to think of agnosticism. I think it's actually a very rare view. I mean, here's the test to determine whether or not you're an agnostic. Suppose that we ask you, do you believe that God exists or not? Give us your answer, and in 5 minutes we're going to find out if you're right or wrong, and if you're wrong, we're going to kill you. Okay, so you're in that situation. If your response is, flip a coin, I don't care, then you're an agnostic.
That was mainly directed to his special circumstances, but I would like to respond to something he said about about the breaking the arm and that kind of thing. He said that God doesn't have to inflict pain to bring about the absence of suffering. God could just bring about, could just create the absence of suffering, could prevent suffering. That is probably true, but in my analogy, breaking my son's arm, of course, would prevent some kind of suffering in the future, but what's broken in us that needs to be rebroken is our character and who we are. And I don't believe that God can take a free moral agent and just inflict him with righteousness if he doesn't want to be a righteous person. I believe that God can give that person incentives to turn that direction and can soften them and make them more sympathetic with what's right through various kinds of trials. But what God's trying to bring about is that which he can't bring about without suffering, because he's dealing with people who have to make their own decision. And the suffering is part of that methodology, in my opinion.
You have questions?
Two questions. So one has to do with sort of the representation of evolutionary theory, and I think you sort of misunderstand the point about the Euthyphro argument. The other sort of more visceral question, though, does regard this problem of evil stuff. I mean, I guess you can tell me that there are hurricanes because we fell from grace in the Garden of Evil, Eden, and the weather went bad, I guess, right? But don't you ever worry about it? I mean, during the 30s when Hitler youth were being trained, right, they were trained by being told to raise puppies, right? And they raised them into dogs, and then they were told to execute the dogs, right? And they were told this. They were told, you don't understand this now. This doesn't make sense to you now, but someday it will. Someday you'll understand the mysteries of blood and soil, and it will, right? How do you know you're not doing the same? Don't you worry that you're doing the same thing when you can find an excuse in principle for any degree of suffering that exists in the world?
So, in other words, the alternative is that God is not a good God. God's an evil God, like Hitler.
No. That's not. The okay. Idea is that, I mean, right now you're relying on faith, right? You're relying on faith when you assume that some story can be. The thing about the Hitler Youth is this, right? I mean, they were violating the tenets of their own immediate, phenomenal, felt moral consciousness when they killed the dogs, right? They were being asked to do something which was against the present tenets of conscience, right? And they did it in the belief that in the long run it would be part of this cosmic story in which it would make some kind of sense, right? Don't you ever worry that you're doing that?
No.
Why not?
I don't. Why? Well, because I believe that the evidence for my belief is rational. I believe it's objective. I've, of course, I've made several references to my own subjective experience, but I'm not arguing from my subjective experience. I'm testifying to it, but I'm saying that my arguments by which I test my subjective experience to see whether it's rational or irrational is compelling and objective.
Okay, if right now, you know, 800 million people are starving to death, mm-hmm. right, and you can look at that, and I bet, right, you're not able to tell the story, right, that makes sense of this. Right. You don't worry.
I might be able to, because if I was one of those people starving to death, I would feel the same way about it as if someone else is, because I really do feel their pain, believe it or not. But I also feel my pain, and I accept that too. What I accept is this, that death is a part of every life. There's never been a person born who either has not died or is going to die, unless we happen to be living in the last generation and Jesus raptures the living saints or whatever. But I'm not counting on that being the case. And so all people die. If someone says, well, why did God let them die in a hurricane? I guess I'd like to say, well, how did you want them to die? If you say, why did God let me die in an accident? Well, how did you want to die?
I don't want them to die with parasites in their bellies.
I don't either.
Right, in screaming agony for weeks. Yeah.
What I really want, since death is inevitable for everyone, what I want is for everyone to die prepared to meet their God. That's what I want. And that's what I'm going to work on, because I can't stop them from dying. If I could stop all hurricanes, I wouldn't stop those people from dying who died in the hurricane. They die another way. The ratio of death to human life is 1:1. There's a 100% mortality rate of the human race. And therefore, it's always tragic when anyone dies. Even Jesus cried at a tomb because it was a tragic thing. Even though he intended to raise that man from the dead at that very moment, he saw death as a tragic intrusion into in the human story that he intends to remedy in the end, and that's what he came to do, to defeat death. And I personally think that every death is tragic, but let's pull ourselves together here and say, okay, it's tragic. Sadly, we're all going to die. Let's see if we can do something about A, making life better for those who are still alive, and B, trying to get people prepared for what's going to happen to them when they die, because it's going to happen.
Okay, this bears upon a question before, right? The question, mm-hmm. I mean, you asked Bill if there was anything that would happen, right, mm-hmm. that would convince him that his theory about the origin, nature, and destiny of the universe are false, mm-hmm. right? And he said there are tons and tons of things. He trotted them out, right? He asked you the same question, right? And now you're giving the same answer. I mean, there is no amount of suffering you could ever see that would make you... There's nothing that could disconfirm this story.
That's true. That's true. But I'll tell you what. He said, is there anything that could convince me that God doesn't exist? He didn't say, is there any amount of suffering? You see, all suffering fits into my worldview. There'd have to be something that is not explicable in my worldview. In fact, that's the thing. Everyone has a worldview. The question is, does your worldview really account for everything, or are there things that it cannot account for? It might seem convenient that a Christian can account for everything by saying it's the will of God or whatever, but hey, if that is a consistent explanation with an otherwise rationally held worldview, don't knock it. If you've got a worldview that can't account for the origin of life, or the origin of information, or the origin of moral absolutes, then maybe you should change your worldview.
Can I go into the second thing?
Yeah.
The second thing is this, right? I mean, the way the debate constantly goes with regard to the evolutionary stuff is this. Mm-hmm. I mean, you point to, right, the evolutionist who's not able to tell some part of the story, right? And you say, well, I can fill it in. God did it. The thing is, that's not an explanation, right?
Sure it is.
It's not even close to being
an explanation. No, it's not a scientific explanation. It's an explanation. But to say that you need to have a scientific explanation for a supernatural fact is imposing artificial rules on the discussion.
It seems like if you say it's supernatural, you're just saying it's inexplicable.
No, I'm saying it's explicable in supernatural terms, not inexplicable.
If you want to talk to him afterwards, that's fine. Do you have any response to that?
Nope.
I'll just stop right there.
Can you ask them afterwards?
This is Mr. Gregg. Also a question towards clarification. You gave one of your more prominent arguments was the eyewitness of Christ's disciples or apostles, and you gave a criteria that kind of set apart those eyewitnesses to other common religious testimonies, i.e., I think you mentioned Mormonism and Islam and whatnot. So clarifying, because you mentioned martyrdom, eyewitness, I'm taking that firsthand experience, mm-hmm. Willing to testify of these things. Are there other criteria that you feel sets the Christian New Testament witness aside or apart from other witnesses?
Quite a few, although I gave the strongest because they are the strongest. But yeah, I believe that the documents of the New Testament, especially the Gospels, are unlike legendary documents. They contain factual information that only an eyewitness would give that has no direct bearing on the story itself. It basically makes all the heroes except Jesus stupid, including the men who are testifying, declare themselves to have been stupid, and it reveals their lack of faith, their dullness. It's not the kind of thing that hero stories is made of. Legends don't usually do that. I mean, these guys who started the church, who after Jesus was gone were supposed to be respected, all the descriptions of them are as a bunch of dullards when Jesus happened to be with them. They don't tend to curry great respect for them. They sound like true accounts in that they're honest admissions of warts and all of the people that they're describing.
Okay, so if you were to list criteria that would need to be met. I mean, because as was pointed out in the debate, many people could claim that this day or some supernatural fact, and as you said, that needs to be eyewitness, multiple individuals, multiple witnesses willing to die or lay down their life for this. What other than that do you feel sets the Christian witness apart? From the other
Well, frankly, I think that's a lot in itself. But
Are there any other criteria?
I'll tell you this. I've done myself. I've spent many years studying the scholarship behind the Gospels and so forth, and the whole of what I've studied inclines me to believe that I'm reading the witness of people who really were telling what they believed to be true. In a court of law, the testimony of similar witnesses would have to be taken as true because it can't be disproven, and it is nothing they say is inconsistent with the general worldview that is presupposed in it, which is a worldview very similar to that which most people throughout history have had, except for a very tiny, tiny number of people who, in especially modern times, have identified themselves as atheists.
Done. Any response?
No, the only thing I would say is that there could be a Muslim scholar up here or a Jewish scholar, and they'd be saying exactly the same thing, basically.
Well, they wouldn't have the same things to say.
They would appeal to different features. They would appeal to different distinctive characteristics of their prophet or their Messiah, whoever they believe is the one that's really carrying the true message from God. And they would say, these are the features that really matter. These are the ones that are really important.
But I didn't refer to the distinctive features of Jesus, but of the records of Jesus and how they stand. I don't think the Muslims could do that. And the Jewish records we accept. You know, the Jewish records.
Except for the parts where they say Jesus is not the Messiah.
Well, that's an opinion. See, that no one can testify that Jesus is not the Messiah or that Jesus is. What people can testify is, I was there when this happened. Now, you reach your own conclusions whether he's the Messiah or not. I say he is, you say he's not, fine. No one can testify that he is or isn't based on eyewitness testimony because that's not visible. You have to base it on the evidence. And that's what I always do in reaching any of my beliefs. I look at the best evidence available, including the evidence for other religions, which I'm interested in too. But I don't think they hold a candle to the sufficiency of the Gospels as historical records. Sorry, I'm taking more than my allotted time.
No, that's fine. Okay.
Thank you, Bill. One more question?
I just had a quick question for Steve. Do you believe that people have to be Christian to be saved or to have a positive afterlife?
You know, that is something that even Christian theologians have been discussing and debating among themselves. What I do believe is nobody can be saved except by Christ and what he has done. Some theologians, and I'm willing to consider their point, believe that Christ is capable of saving people who had no opportunity to hear about him in this lifetime. If they were otherwise disposed toward seeking the truth and seeking God and so forth.
Yeah, I guess where I was going with that is it seems like there's a special problem for people who've never had the opportunity, even through missionaries or whatever, who then undergo through great suffering.
Yeah, the Gospel of John says that the condemnation of the world is that light has come into the world and they love the darkness rather than light. Mm-hmm. I believe that people who have not received very much light will not be condemned in the same way that people who've received much light and have hated the light. I think people who have been responsive to whatever light God has given them may well be counted as believers, even if they've not heard the name of Jesus, just like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob never heard the name of Jesus.
I guess that's why Catholics had limbo. I think that...
Why they have to... Oh, they have limbo for babies, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Oh, you want to ask a question?
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being such a wonderful audience. I think we host Steve and Mr. Ramsey... round of applause for being so gracious to come here. And are you available for questions afterwards?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're available for questions afterwards, and I want to thank you for being a wonderful audience. Have a great night. Mm-hmm.